3374, Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about the bill? Senator Walker, come on forward. Welcome, everyone. As you can see, we have a fairly lengthy agenda today. We're going to try and get the judges and elected officials in and out of here first. So we'll do the best we can. For real people, if you have someplace you need to be, send us a note. Steve Law, that doesn't include you. You don't have to be anywhere. So, all right, Senator Walker, take it away.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7 from Eugene. I'm competing with a weed eater outside. That's pretty good. This shouldn't take very long. House Bill 3374, Ms. Harris is going to explain to you, and then I'll tell you what I want to do to it.
Thank you.
House Bill 3374 modifies certain provisions relating to residency for purposes of motor vehicle titles and registration, and we have a dash 4 amendment.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. The amendment I'm addressing is the dash 4. The underlying bill is a fine bill, an awfully fine bill. Representative Crummell introduced the original bill, and it was amended to be what you see today. I informed him that I was going to use his bill to add one of my bills to it. He took no position on my amendment, so I will just state that for the record. So, Madam Chair, what I am attempting to do with the dash 4 amendment is to insert a little bill that went across the Senate floor with 21 aye votes and 6 no votes back on May 3rd, and that bill would require commercial delivery vehicles to put a forward mirror on their trucks so that they don't run over little children and kill them. And as you know from my testimony, Madam Chair, previously, I have a constituent whose daughter was run over by a UPS truck because the delivery driver could not see her standing on the sidewalk, and if he had had a forward mirror, he would have been able to see her, as was concluded by the detectives investigating the crime. It wasn't really a crime. I guess it was an accident. So, Madam Chair, that's Senate Bill 1027. That would be the dash A4 amendment. I have made two modifications to that bill that went off the Senate floor because there were some objections from the 6 members who voted no. So I believe I'm taking care of their concerns. One is that we are defining the vehicle weight so that we could make sure that we are indeed getting the vehicles that we are looking at. So we have defined that weight to be between 10,000 pounds and less than 26,000 pounds. The other item that we put in the bill was to exempt for agricultural vehicles. So with those two little modifications, we just might get complete support in the Senate. I would tell you that the chairman of the House Transportation Committee would not give my bill a hearing, and I expect we may or may not get concurrence, but Madam Chair, I need to do what I need to do for my constituents. This is a serious problem. This was not the only child in the state who's been run over by a commercial vehicle that was not equipped with a front mirror. It's a very simple fix for a very tragic problem.
Thank you, Senator Walker. Did the chair of the Transportation Committee let you know why he wasn't giving the bill a hearing?
He just said he didn't want to do it. It was too broad. That was my understanding. And I told him that I would be willing to amend the bill, but I think he just felt that it was too broad of a requirement.
All right. Thank you. Questions for Senator Walker? Senator Ringo.
Thanks, Madam Chair. This is a good bill with other number. It's a good bill, this number. But I don't find that I have the amendments.
Okay.
There I am. Thank you very much.
You're welcome very much. All right. Any other questions for Senator Walker? Thank you very much. Appreciate you joining us today. We'll probably finish hearing the bill and dealing with it later on in the agenda. So.
Yes, you have a full house. I did not know this was the happening place. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Let's open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1068. Ms. Harris, and this is the issue we've been wrestling with the last several days now.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 1068 creates a crime of violating a release agreement. We heard this on the 22nd and again yesterday, and there are some amendments that we were considering yesterday, and I think we might have some additional testimony today.
Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Yes.
I met with both proponents and opponents of the bill this morning, and we kind of went around and around the same issues that the committee heard.
Senator Ringo, before you go into much detail, Judge Legert is here, and I'd like her to come up.
Okay.
And we're actually officially in work session.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, Atkinson, and Farrelly. My name is Terry Legert, and I'm a judge here in Marion County. Just found out about this bill this morning. The court staff at our court administrator's office sent an email out, and I just want to say that I think it's a solution in search of a problem, because the people are already being arrested for violating their release agreements. In the case I have, the DV case that I have, if there's a FAPA, there is a contempt of court on that.
Mm-hmm.
If there's a new crime committed because of the contact, they're being charged with a new crime, which is appropriate. And I'd like to say the caveat I have on all this is a lot of the contact that happens between defendants and the victims in this case, not a lot, but a big percentage, is a result of two things: instigated by the victim, trying to sort out, you know, parenting issues or money issues or property issues because people have been ordered not to have contact. The victims often come to court and want to have contact. We have a policy in our county that says you can't until the criminal case is resolved. We try and straighten out some of the financial and parenting issues. And the other thing, so I'm very concerned about creating a crime of when it's instigated by the victim. And then the last thing is there's a lot of communication issues for people that are non-English speakers, native English speakers, because a lot of the release agreements are being done at the jail prior to coming to court. At the courts, we try to explain a lot of detail what's supposed to happen in terms of no contact. I have resorted, I'm doing the jail full-time right now and have been for 6 months, to telling defendants, if the victim calls you up, you need to tell her you can't talk to her and hang up. If she persists, you're to call the police. If she comes to your house, same thing. Because the who gets arrested is the defendant on the no contact, not the victim that's there. And a lot of these, and we just had one today, these people were driving to a parenting class together that I ordered the defendant to go to, and the kid had to go with them. So there are contacts that are in violation of release agreement. They're not, I mean, offensive to that extent. And I think we need to just, the person can be arrested already under the statute. I did look at the -2 amendments that are before you, and I actually think they're a good idea just because it says it applies to any victim, whether or not it's a DV case. And why shouldn't a victim in a non-DV case? I mean, because sometimes it's offensive contact. They're calling up and, you know, trying to get the person to drop charges. Again, I assume that would be a tampering with a witness charge. So I don't understand why you need a separate new charge to do this. And I think it's going to create, I mean, in my court, it's going to result in a lot of additional charges, criminal charges being filed. I predict that. We already revoke release agreements when the DA requests it. If the person's had, you know, offensive contact in violation of the order, if there's new crimes that are committed while they're on release, release agreements revoked. I just don't understand why they need to have a separate crime for violation of release agreement. So that was my comment. I thought at first when I got the email you were going to be telling us what kind of font we need on our release agreements, and I discovered that wasn't quite where we were going. But
we did have that conversation yesterday. It was pretty clear from the release agreements that both the OCDLA and the DA's Association provided us is that some counties, the no contact order was in itty-bitty print, and at least in Marion County it was in big, huge letters, so your county got kudos. And,
And actually we included on the back page what we mean by contact, because that's another thing. They think contact means touching something. You know, I mean, and if you're talking about language barriers, it becomes worse. So those are my comments.
All right. Thanks for complicating our decision-making even further. Who would like to ask the judge any questions? Senator Ringo.
Thank you. Thanks for coming this afternoon, Judge.
Sure.
We heard testimony that in some counties, contempt orders are issued, but in other counties, they're never issued. And in other counties, nothing happens. If there is a, when the victim and the perpetrator arrive at the courthouse together, there's essentially no sanction for that.
Well, Chair Brown, Senator Ringo, I think part of that might be the judge looking at, well, the victim wants to have contact with him, so why should I put him in jail when she said, hey, let's go over to court together? On the other hand, if it's unwarranted contact, you know, I mean, not appropriate contact, you're making those calls. In some counties, too, Senator Ringel, the DAs don't charge people on domestic violence cases, but that's charging practices very widely across the state, and the same thing's true about judges. And we have to make those judgment calls every day about what is... I mean, here's another thing that happens. We'll have no-contact orders, and the parents show up at the juvenile court because the juvenile court has ordered them to come in and, you know, participate in a, I don't know, family decision meeting. So I'm sure there is a wide variety. I'm not going to dispute there's wide variety, but there's wide variety in charging practices too.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
There we go.
The bill is based on the idea that the perpetrators have a tremendous amount of influence over the victim, in that they will coerce the victim into recanting their stories, and you know, that seems to be the pattern in domestic violence cases, and you haven't addressed that. You haven't acknowledged that.
No, go ahead.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Chair Brown, Senator Ringel, absolutely. There's no question about that, but not every single one of these cases is like that. I've had cases, this one person was charged with contacting the victim. She called him 200 times. He called her back. Well,
Madam Chair, this is the second, third hearing on this, I think.
Senator Ringo, third. And it's actually only a work session.
Yeah.
But each time, I mean, I think it's clear that you can give instances where you're right. The victim is trying vigorously to initiate the contact. And then on the other side of it, you've got the perpetrator that has an abusive and dominating relationship. And this bill is trying to make a policy choice that latter example, where there's an abusive, dominating relationship, that we have to stop that to prevent ongoing domestic violence. And so how do we know? What do
okay.
we do?
Well, Chair Brown, Senator Ringo, here's what I'm trying to say is, we already have the criminal charge. The assault charge is pending. They're going to be, and the fact that they are having contact while the case is pending, their release agreement can be revoked, and they'll be sentenced. You have to trust, that the courts are going to be looking at, who is this person? And sorting that person out from the person who's charged with a criminal offense that maybe they're not guilty of, and then they have a new charge of contact because they respond to that other person for whatever reason, and they get convicted of that even though the underlying charge is not appropriate. So this is if your mind is pre-commissioned, I agree with you 100%. There's dominant, those control issues. I suggest that in the appropriate case, a lot of the cases, there's FAPAs, there's mandatory arrest. So what I'm saying is they already have the ability to arrest. They're back in jail. You've stopped the contact. You reiterate that. I mean, and then again, we have our jails being full, which is a whole different issue. But in our county, our jails are filled with these people because that's the priority person that's held, not the PCS person, or, possession. So I agree with you completely, Senator Ringel. I'm just saying, do you need another crime to take care of the problem?
I'm very ambivalent to this, to tell you the truth. Either way, Madam Chair, just another question. Senator Brown mentioned that it appeared that Marion County's forms were better than some other counties in terms of notifying.
I helped design them. Thank you.
Congratulations.
I did not know that for the record.
In terms of notifying the perpetrators that they were subject to a no-contact order. But some of these forms don't seem very good. And even Marion County's could be better, I think. Sorry, you're the one who designed it.
I don't know if you looked on the back, because we also defined what contact meant. We took it from the FAPA statute.
Do you think it would be useful to make that even more clear? We were discussing legislation that would require a notice in, I don't know, a 14-point type or some large, bold letters to say no contact really means no contact, and if there is contact...
You could be arrested. Right. Chair Brown, Senator Ringel, I agree that the emails around the state, because that was what the email was about, was could we change our forms? Everybody said, sure, fine, we just hate to throw away all our old forms, but we're happy to do that, whatever. But we changed our form a long time ago to define what contact meant so we didn't have to argue about it, and that's on the back page, which you probably didn't see. It comes from the FAPA legislation. But absolutely. I mean, and that's just fair to the defendant. So that they understand we're not just talking about contact meaning touching, we mean calling, sending letters, having somebody else do it. We make it real clear. It's not just you, it's anybody else.
Thank you.
Sure, thanks.
Any other questions for Judge Legert? We'll let you get back
Thank
to work.
You.
Thank you so much for joining us and confusing us even further. I'm going to close the work session for the time being on Senate Bill 1068. Let's go ahead and go down to... Let's go these guys.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo.
Just a comment on 1068. I was interested in language that would require a certain notice in the form, but Ledge Council has informed us it doesn't fit within the relating clause.
Okay.
So then we considered exploring other vehicles.
And then my understanding was, at least in talking to the records folks yesterday, is that they could do that without us passing a bill.
That
would certainly be my preference. All right. I'm going to try and make a little more room in the hearing room and open a public hearing on House Bill 2828.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2828.
Okay. All right. We're going to do both House Bill 2828 and House Bill 3037 for Representative Barker. Senator Atkinson, I don't know if you want to join him at the dais.
Thanks. Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2828A expands the crime of murder to include death committed with criminal negligence by a person driving under the influence of intoxicants. If the person has a certain type of prior record, including either seriously injuring or killing someone due to driving under the influence or a certain number of previous DUI charges. House Bill 3037 expands the crime of aggravated murder to include the murder of a witness in a juvenile proceeding if the murder was related to the performance of the victim's official duties as a witness. And we have amendments for both of these bills.
Okay. All right. All right, Representative Barker, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Brown and members of the committee. For the record, I'm State Representative Jeff Barker from District 28, Beaverton, Loa. I know you have a very busy schedule today, so I'm going to keep this pretty brief.
Thank you.
Under current law, an intoxicated driver who kills another person can be charged with manslaughter in the first or second degree or criminally negligent homicide. Similarly, an intoxicated driver who causes serious physical injury to another person can be charged with assault in the second, third, or fourth degree. House Bill 2828A increases both penalties to murder and to assault in the first degree when a driver already has either three or more prior drunk driving convictions, DUI convictions, in Oregon or another state, or one prior conviction in which someone was killed or suffered serious physical injury. Basically, they, of all people, should know better. That's why House Bill 2828 was written, to hold these drivers to a higher standard of justice than other intoxicated drivers. In order to address the concerns of members who oppose the death penalty, the bill amends the aggravated murder statute to clarify that if more than one person dies in the accident, the intoxicated driver cannot be charged with aggravated murder.
All right.
That's on that.
Questions for Representative Barker?
I have a question.
Senator Atkinson.
Thank you. Could you describe for me the opposition that was held in the House? Was there opposition or were people silent?
No, there was no testimony in opposition on that bill on the House.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll bring you up, but don't worry. Okay. As far as you're aware, there was no testimony in opposition. Okay, let's move to House Bill 3037.
Okay, thank you once again, Chair Brown and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jeff Barker, District 28, Naloa. Let me begin by asserting that I do not believe this bill is an expansion of the death penalty, but rather it closes a gap that was opened by the Oregon Court of Appeals in their 2000 ruling, State versus Thompson. House Bill 3037 simply includes the murder of witnesses with the intention of disrupting a juvenile proceeding in Oregon's aggravated murder statute. Witnesses are a vital part of the criminal justice system, whether in adult or juvenile court. Why should murdering one type of witness be deemed a more serious crime than the murder of another type? House Bill 3037 is not just about correcting a technicality created by the appeals court, but rather creating fairness for crime victims and protecting witnesses. I do not know if you'll be hearing more about this case from Mary Thompson, but let me give you a brief history of the case that led to this. In 1994, Aaron Atura witnessed a stabbing by a juvenile suspect and agreed to cooperate with the authorities. 2 days before the beginning of his trial, two other juveniles broke into the Atura's home and shot Aaron in the back of the head while he was asleep. The execution was ordered by Mary Thompson, the mother of the juvenile accused in the stabbing. Mrs. Thompson was referred to as the, quote, gang mom by her son's associates, and was convicted of aggravated murder because the murder was intended to disrupt the official duties of a witness. She was sentenced to a term of life in prison without the possibility of parole until her sentence was overturned by the Court of Appeals. They reasoned that a juvenile proceeding was not the same as a criminal proceeding, and they reduced her sentence to 25 years. I believe that this constitutes an absurd imbalance in our criminal justice system, and I urge you to pass 3037. Thank you again for hearing the bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions from Representative Barker? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Senator Atkinson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Colleagues, for the record, Jason Atkinson.
And Representative Barker, you're welcome to stay or okay, leave it. And you're welcome to join us at the dais if you wish. That's fine, too.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Again, for the record, Senator Jason Atkinson from Southern Oregon. Thank you, Madam Chair, for holding this hearing and for allowing us to testify. With me today, driving all the way up this morning from Josephine County, is Josephine County Sheriff Dave Daniel, who actually brought this issue to my attention. And you'll also see representatives of various other agencies from around our state in law enforcement dealing with part of the law that can be fixed relatively easily, which is giving the same protection to reserve officers that we give to inline officers in the event of a crime that takes place against them. Essentially what I said in the various times on this issue has been the fact that the Oregon law stands behind one officer but doesn't stand behind the reserve officers. And so thank you very much for allowing us to have this. I think it's best held by the professionals, and I'm going to let Sheriff speak and the rest of his colleagues that have come up and join you back at the dais.
Thank you. Sheriff Daniel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senators. Dave Daniel, Sheriff Dave Daniel, Sheriff of Josephine County and Grants Pass. I did drive up this morning because I think this is an extremely important issue. Because of an incident that occurred in Josephine County, I approached Jason with the possibility of getting this amendment going to fix an issue. I don't think we're adding a protective class. We were fixing something that should have happened a long time ago, but it didn't. And I'm urging the committee to please pass this important amendment. And I'd like to just make a few comments about what happened in Josephine County. On December 23, 2004, at 9:45 p.m., our dispatchers received a 911 call of a domestic disturbance between a husband and a wife. The first patrol car on the scene was being driven by a regular deputy. His passenger was Reserve Deputy Timothy Cockrum. They pulled up in front of the residence, and as both officers were exiting the patrol vehicle, gunfire erupted from the residence. Reserve Deputy Cochran went down yelling that he had been hit. The driver's door of the patrol vehicle took the brunt of the shotgun blast aimed at the driver, and he wasn't hit. The driver and deputies who arrived shortly after the shooting were able to pull the injured deputy out of the line of fire and get him to a hospital. His bulletproof vest saved his life, but several pellets from the shotgun blast entered his side where there is no protection from the vest. Thank God none of the pellets hit any vital organs, and he is back to work at his regular job and still volunteering his time as a reserve with the Josephine County Sheriff's Office. Tim Cochran is like hundreds of men and women in Oregon who have regular jobs but volunteer their time and service to their communities by becoming reserve officers for police and sheriff's offices across the state. These men and women receive hundreds of hours of training in law enforcement and firearms. They wear the same uniform as the officers they are working with. Any person intent on killing an officer would never notice the difference between a regular officer and a reserve officer. These men and women place their lives on the line every time they put on their uniforms and volunteer their time, the same as every law enforcement officer across our nation. In Oregon, we give some added protection to our regular law enforcement officers by having an aggravated murder law that goes into effect should an officer be killed in the line of duty. Unfortunately, we didn't give that same protection to reserve officers when this law was enacted. House Bill 3037 will fix that omission and give these brave men and women who serve our communities proudly the same protection as the officers they serve with. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Senator Brown, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to come and speak. I'm Chief Vernon Wells from the Independence Police Department. Today I'm representing also the Oregon Chiefs Association, and I know the room is full, so we'll make it fairly quick. But we do strongly believe in this bill and believe that every law enforcement officer should be treated the same. We rely on our reserves a great deal, especially in small agencies, to supplement our regular force. We ask them to do that at little or no pay, and it seems almost silly to not provide them the same kind of protection we do our regular officers. Clearly, the bad guys who intend to inflict deadly harm on a police officer will not know the difference, or will rarely know the difference between the regular and the reserve officer. So the Police Chiefs Association, again, strongly support this bill and hope that you do. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Shields, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm talking about, first of all, House Bill 2828, and I just wanted to express to the committee that while there might not have been any opposition on the floor, there might not have been any opposition in committee. Some of us did vote no on the floor, and I just wanted to explain why. Some of you know one of my best friends, Arwin Bird, who was hit by a drunk driver and left paralyzed and is now in a wheelchair. Several years ago, she and her sister, Sierra, were hit head-on. Arwin was left in a wheelchair. Sierra was left with a significant brain injury. Arwin would have been here today to testify in opposition to 2828, but she's now going through surgery because of in her shoulders had become so taxed with moving her wheelchair. I passed out Arwin's testimony. I'm not going to read the entire thing, but I did want to read at least a couple of sentences into the record. She says, "Several years ago, I was hit by a drunk driver. I am now paralyzed, must use a wheelchair, and face significant barriers every moment of every day. Although I have suffered great pain and loss as a result of a drunk driver, I am writing in opposition to House Bill 2828 because I feel the costs of this bill are too high. Simply creating additional penalties with longer prison sentences does nothing to address the causes of driving under the influence and reduces funding for alcohol and drug treatment for DUI offenders by shifting funds to prison beds." She also talks about how the medical expenses she has, this takes money away from the state to support victims, and it also does not address the issue of prevention. The last sentence she had, I think, was most important. She says, "If I believe this bill would prevent one death by drunk driving, I would support it. But I do not, and I therefore urge your no vote on House Bill 2828. On June 16th in the New York Times, there was a story about a DUI bill in the United States Senate that would press the states to adopt stiffer sentences. And in the summary, there were some very interesting lines. The summary noted that little progress has been made in drunk driving death tolls over the last 9 years. One advocate for tougher sentences said, "We can't have the status quo of 17,000 people dying year after year after year after year." She continued, quote, "Since 1995, the numbers have not really moved. Since 1995, the numbers have not really moved." Now, all of you know that since 1995, the country has increased sentences dramatically for DUI, yet the deaths don't seem to change. And related to this bill, maybe we should try something different rather than locking people up for 25 years. How about increasing the ignition interlocks? How about beginning to treat drinking as a privilege, not as a right? If you look at page 2 of the fiscal, it says that these costs could be significant in out biennium. Now, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I agree with Arwin when she states that if this bill would save one life, these significant costs would be worth it. But I'm unconvinced it will save one life. For 9 years, we haven't moved the number of 17,000 deaths. I suggest we move towards a more balanced approach. Jail and prisons, yes, but more treatment, more prevention for more public safety. And I would suggest that you decide not to move this out of committee today.
Thank you. Questions for Representative Shields? Did you want to testify on House Bill 3037?
I did. Thank you.
All right.
As much as I hate to be on the other side of the senator from Southern Oregon and my colleague from Loa, I just wanted to express my opposition to 3037, and it's simply a principled stand. It's that I oppose the death penalty, and I think that we have the option in the state of making the top sentence mandatory life imprisonment. We can accomplish the same public safety results, and that's what I suggest we do. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate you joining us. All right. Let's go. Steve Dole, Ms. Furlich. I have two Ms. Furliches. Both come on up. Good afternoon and welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Steve Dole from Crime Victims United of Oregon, and I want to say, Chair Brown, thank you very much for your courtesy in hearing House Bill 2828. Obviously, Crime Victims United has brought the bill, and we are here in support of the bill, and the ladies sitting next to me are the reasons that we originally brought this bill. The Furlich family suffered a great loss back in 1998, which Jane Furlich, the aunt and daughter of the victims, will tell you about. But there's just a couple of things that I would like to address regarding the bill. This bill is, first of all, addresses a very narrow band of offenders. These are offenders who have previously killed someone with their automobile while DUI or while under the influence of drugs. These are people who have previously seriously injured someone while previously under DUI, or this is someone who has had three or more DUI convictions. So again, we're talking about a very narrow band. These incidents don't happen very often, but when they do, as you'll hear today, they are horrific. There are some who have wanted to create a new crime around this for the reason that they have an objection with the issue of the use of the word murder. I might say this, that in Oregon, as opposed to some other states, we do not have to have a premeditated state for murder. In Oregon, you can commit murder by either intent, recklessness, abuse, criminal negligence, or felony, what we call felony murder. And one of the, I know there was an objection by one of the senators, and the senator discussed the objection with me, and that was Senator Krasanski, and I want to address that. We've sent you up there's on one of our pieces of testimony, there's a piece in there about Texas law. And Senator's objection was around the issue of the fact that his sister was a murder victim, and I certainly understand that. My daughter was also a murder victim. And he believed that it somewhat diminished the issue of murder by calling murder by intoxication. Because of the issue of premeditation. In Texas, we have found that they do have a felony murder statute for intoxication. And in fact, the piece of testimony that I've handed to you involves a case of a 35-year-old man who was driving with a blood alcohol content of 0.23 and was charged with the murder of a 5-year-old child. Due to the fact it was the offender's third DUI offense, prosecutors pursued felony murder charges, which he was convicted of and then sentenced to a term of 55 years in prison. So we encourage you to take a close look at this bill. We encourage you to pass the bill. There's one other issue that I'd like to bring up, and that is the issue of treatment, which the good representative from Portland brought up. In the Bend Bulletin, they spoke to this issue. Treatment, we're not against treatment. We're certainly for treatment. But the type of people that this bill addresses are beyond that. We can pour a lot of money into treatment, and that's a good idea, but it will not help the people who would be imprisoned under House Bill 2828 or save the people that they will kill. And with that, again, I thank you, Chair, and I will turn this over to Ms. Furlich.
Thank you. Go ahead. Good afternoon, Chair Brown and members of the Senate Rules Committee. My name is Jane Furlich, and I'm a resident of Washington County. I'm here today to speak in support of House Bill 2828A. Have you ever set out for the beach on a sunny day? Did you take your family? Did you go out Highway 26, maybe to Cannon Beach or Seaside? Did you stop at the Sitka Spruce? Did you marvel at how big it was? Maybe you even ran around it. What if that was your last memory on Earth? Would it be enough? Would it be enough for your family? To my left, my mother-in-law, Angela Furlich, has that last memory of her husband, Martin, and her granddaughter, Jennifer. And it isn't enough. Jennifer and Martin Furlich were killed just a few moments after easing back onto Highway 26 after visiting the Sitka Spruce. They were planning to spend the day at Cannon Beach. But someone killed them. And this man had killed before. Early in the morning, on July 18, 1999, James Lincoln Willie stole his friend's methadone, mixed it with Valium and Klonopin, ingested it, and drove his Ford Econoline van over the center line. Not once, but several times that clear, sunny Sunday. First, he did a hit and run in Astoria, then almost hit a school bus full of high school athletes, then came over the center line toward the Honda Accord driven by Martin. Martin tried to pull over to the right, but there was a ditch there. He slammed on the brakes, but the van hit him head-on, killing him instantly. Angela heard a roaring noise, looked at Martin, saw the steering wheel impaled into his chest, and knew her husband of 43 years was gone. Quickly, she looked to the back seat where Jennifer had been sitting. 12-year-old Jennifer was laying down, already turning blue. Then Angela heard herself screaming. It's been almost 6 years since we entered this nightmare. How many times have we awoken screaming? How many times have we broken down crying? How many times have we asked, why us? How many times have we asked, why was he even on the road? You see, James Lincoln Willie had killed his wife and best friend while driving drunk in 1977. He was convicted of criminally negligent homicide and received a sentence of 5 years. He only served 2 years and 4 months. After his release, he was convicted several times for DUI, multiple assaults, robberies, and a hit and run in 1987 that caused injury while he was driving with a suspended license. He received a fine of $750 and 5 years probation for that one. James Willie had his license revoked 6 times in Oregon, yet he was driving on the road that day. James Willie was convicted of 2 counts of manslaughter, 2 for killing Martin and Jennifer, and 1 count of assault, 2 for seriously injuring Angela. We agreed to a plea bargain of 16 years. 16 years for 2 deaths and 1 serious injury. That's all. However, at the time, we thought it would be a life sentence for Willie because his health was so poor due to his drug abuse. Who knew that Willie would actually get healthier in prison? He will get out in 10 years, and even though he knows what happens when he drives while intoxicated, he will probably do it anyway, and more innocent people will die. I was asked to tell you how our lives have changed by James Willie's murder spree. Our family lost our father, our Opa, a generous and loving man who could fix anything, a wise man, the youngest of 6 and the only boy in his family, the one who took care of everything, the one we all turned to for advice and help, whether it was money matters or how to do something. His wife has to hire someone now to do the work Martin used to do. She has to ask her son to take care of her finances. She thinks she may have to sell the house that Martin built. She worries constantly. Angela barely survived the crash, and she is here today to show you how this horrible crime has affected her.
Her multiple injuries of broken bones, humerus, foot, ribs, shattered eye orbit, head injuries, a concussion, facial fractures and lacerations, a collapsed lung, lacerated liver, deep bruising, and multiple lacerations on her body still plague her today. She continues to receive physical therapy because her back, shoulders, and arm never healed properly after the crash. Her broken arm healed crooked, but after so many days in the hospital, compounded by a staph infection, she couldn't face another surgery to have the broken arm fixed. She tends to overdo things because it's only her now to take care of the house and large yard. She is often anxious, tired, and depressed. Maureen Furlich, Jennifer's mother, continues to grieve for the loss of her only child every day. Every day she wakes up hoping it was just a bad dream. But the dream is real, and so is the pain. The pain is so bad that even though Maureen was able to attend the house hearing, she's not able to attend today's hearing. Everything Maureen did in life, she did with Jennifer in mind. As a single parent, she moved back in with her parents so they could help raise Jennifer. Maureen worked two jobs so Jennifer could have nice clothes. She planned her work schedule to be home when Jennifer was home. Now there was no one to care for, no one she has to be home for. There will be no dates for Jennifer, no prom, no college, no wedding, no career as a poet or an artist or an interior designer. Jennifer was dyslexic and had struggled in school, but she was the kind of student every teacher dreamed of. She overcame her dyslexia to become a profound poet. She was very helpful at school and was a buddy to the younger kids at Mary Woodward Elementary in Tigard, Oregon. When one little boy broke his leg and couldn't participate in a big dance performance, Jennifer wiped away his tears and told him she would be his legs. She pushed his wheelchair for the big dance number as he sang and gestured with his hands. Because of her own struggles, she was always sensitive to others' needs. But did Willie care? No, because James Willie crashed into her, causing her brain to hemorrhage, which killed her the next day. This year was especially hard because Jennifer would have been a senior in high school, but we didn't watch her graduate. We visited her grave instead. My daughter Maria was especially close to Jennifer. We have not been able to take Maria to the beach since this happened. She's afraid she'll be killed before we get there. And with all the repeat DUI drivers on the road, it certainly could happen. One-third of all DUI arrests are repeat offenders, and 40% of all traffic deaths are alcohol-related. I support Bill 2828A because repeat DUI drivers who kill and seriously injure innocent people should get a mandatory sentence of 25 years. They know the consequences of their actions because it happened before. Keep these repeat offenders in prison longer so no other family will have to go through our nightmare. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, and it's fair to say we are very sorry for your losses. Any questions for this family? Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Mr. Dole, why don't you stay up here and give us testimony on 3037 as well? And I'm going to have to ask, we're under pretty time frames at this point. I would really ask people to keep their testimony to under 2 minutes.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Steve Dole from Crime Victims United, House Bill 3037, as addressed before, addresses a problem that we have in Oregon in the statutes regarding aggravated murder, and you're going to hear some people who will come up and oppose this and call this an expansion of the death penalty. This is not an expansion of the death penalty. To me, an expansion of the death penalty would be what we did in this body back in 1997 when we stated that it would be aggravated murder to murder a child in the state of Oregon. That was passed by this body, and it was signed by Governor Kitzhaber at the time. It created a whole new class of people who could be charged with that crime and face either the death penalty, life without the possibility of parole, or life with the possibility of parole after 30 years. This merely takes existing classes and makes sure that everyone in those classes are protected, both victim and equal protection for the perpetrators themselves. It is, as someone stated, it's absolutely absurd to think that in the case of such as Ms. Itura, who I hope that you will hear from, that her son, who witnessed a juvenile crime, who I believe was the perpetrator is 14 years old, that is not aggravated murder. Yet if I were to witness a 24-year-old doing the same crime and I were murdered, then that would be an aggravated murder case. That is absurd. The same thing goes for police officers, and we completely support Senator Atkins' amendment. The fact that a police officer who's killed in the line of duty, that it would be aggravated murder in the case of a regular police officer and not in the case of a reserve. You're going to hear from the Catholic Church that they oppose it. I want to tell you, I speak to you here today as a lifelong Catholic, born, baptized into the Church. And at one time, the Church supported the death penalty. They don't happen to support it now. We don't know what the next pope is going to do. But the bottom line is things change in the Church as things change in government. I guess, and I don't mean to be flip with this, and I'll end with this, the best analogy that I can give you on this is this. If you passed a law today that said we're going to protect all legislators and we're going to make it aggravated murder if you murder a legislator, that would be creating a new class. But let's assume that that law existed. And then all of a sudden, a legislator was murdered who was appointed. And the court said, we're not going to protect that particular legislator. They weren't elected. They were just appointed. That's the analogy I would make to what's going on here. And I hope that you will take a good look at this law. And again, pass 3037 and clear up an issue that is just not right in Oregon and protect all classes within these two, reserve police or police officers and witnesses. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We're going to temporarily close the public hearings on, unless anybody has any questions for Mr. Dole, House Bill 2828 and House Bill 3037, and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1072. Senator Nelson, I know you've been working hard.
Work session too.
Sure.
Not that I'm bashful.
Public hearing and work session.
Thank you. My name is David Nelson, State Senator from Pendleton. This is Senate Bill 1072. We have agreement on the Dastrey amendments. If you folks have those in front of you, they're very short, basically. First two pages are the same as the other bill. On page three, on lines eight, we put in the words facilitate the development of stewardship contracts. We deleted pilot programs because there's 84 pilot programs throughout the United States right now. On line 20, we added the G, perform other activities related to stewardship. This came as a request from the governor's office and actually was in the original bill. On page 4, on lines 5, we changed the word direct and put in coordinate with Oregon State University. And on line 13, I think this probably was in the, on page 5, line 13, there's the term mitigating action. I think one of the things that we talked about in the hearing was whether or not there was, whether this was a continuous thing or just mitigating action. So we put in the word mitigating. On lines 23, we added the sentence, forest values include water, wildlife, and recreation. That was at a request of the environmental groups. And then on this is the substantive change that we made, basically, is lines 26 on. We deleted the definition of biomass that we had in the bill and put in the definition that was approved in the House in House Bill 3481 at page 10, line 22. That was passed out of the House sometime earlier this week. And then we kept in the language without diminishing the biological product of the land while providing for the conservation of mature trees and old growth and while taking into consideration those things were all left in. And we deleted lines 2 through 7 of the dash 2 amendments, which referred to some black liquor, things of that nature that didn't really belong in the bill. So I'm sure the environmental groups are not entirely happy. I don't think industry is entirely happy, but I think this is a bill they can live with, and I think this is a very important component of what's going on in the world. Is what I'm finding out is that there's a huge amount of these. Well, not huge. There's 84 pilot projects in the United States. This is the way the states are now, and the federal government are trying to take care of federal forests. And the requirements for the federal government are very strong, and so I feel there's a great amount of protection here. So I'd ask that the committee move the bill, and if it would answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions?
Madam Chair, I just want to thank Senator Nelson for working with the Enviros and bringing everybody together on this. I just really commend you.
Great. Any other questions? All right. We're in work session. Chair. Senator Ringo.
I move the dash 3 amendments to House Bill 1072.
It's actually a Senate bill, but...
Senate Bill 1072.
Senator Ringo's moved the dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 1072. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing, seeing none. So ordered, Senator Ringo.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 1072 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Ringo has moved Senate Bill 1072 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing, seeing none. So ordered. Senator Nelson, you want to carry? Thank you. Good work. All right. Let's go back up to House Bill 2828 and House Bill 3037. Buffalo Zobel. Ann Pratt and Mark McDonnell. Good afternoon and welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify today. My name is Buffalo Zobel. My first thoughts were of anger at Timothy Saldani, the person who hit me while driving drunk. Then they turned to anger at the system. I believe the system needs to do much more to address those dangerous, hardcore, repeat offenders who continue to drive while intoxicated by holding them more appropriately accountable. I believe House Bill 2828A does just that. This is what happened to me. Around 7:15 in the morning of Saturday, June 24th, 2000, I left my house for a 17-mile marathon training run. I was running along Borland Road in West Lynn, which is a moderately traveled country road with clearly marked shoulders. I was running west on the shoulder, facing eastbound oncoming traffic. Timothy Saldani was also traveling west on Borland Road. He crossed over the solid double yellow line across the eastbound traffic lane onto the shoulder and struck me from behind with his car. From the impact, I was thrown into the car's windshield, crashing through the driver's side, and then careened off the back of the car. It was bad enough that Mr. Saldani was intoxicated and driving with a suspended license in a stolen car, but he fled the scene of the crash. I was very fortunate that there were people nearby who came to my aid and called the police and ambulance. These people indeed saved my life. It is a miracle that I am alive. This was not the first time Mr. Saldani had been cited or convicted of DUI. In 1996, he was convicted of DUI. In early 2000, he was cited for driving with a blood alcohol content of 0.12. He was cited again in March of 2000 when he refused a breathalyzer test. In my case, he was apprehended in Lake Oswego shortly after he hit me, but refused a breathalyzer test at the scene. It was 3 hours later before he was forced to give a blood sample for blood alcohol level, and it was 0.13. It was estimated to be at 0.17 at the time of the collision. Timothy Saldani was found guilty and sentenced to 8 years for assault 2, felony hit and run, unauthorized use of a vehicle, DUII, and driving with a suspended license. I believe this is not long enough to make a difference for this type of violent offender, and the punishment does not fit the crime. House Bill 2828A will help strengthen the convictions and penalties for drunk driving and may also deter more people from driving while under the influence. I believe these DUII repeat offenders should face more severe consequences for their reckless choices that can kill or maim innocent victims. This has severely affected the lives of my wife, my family and friends, as well as me. The pain and suffering we've all been through has been tremendous. I was in the hospital for almost 6 weeks. The doctors performed 14 surgeries in the first 2.5 years to totally reconstruct the lower part of both my legs. My 15th surgery was to rebuild my shoulder. In less than 1 year, my medical bills far exceeded $250,000. I was once very active, a marathon runner, and now I'm working very hard to return to some semblance of my old form. Because of Mr. Soldani's actions, I'm in pain every day and probably will be the rest of my life. But I consider myself lucky to be alive. Many families have lost loved ones to drunk drivers. If this bill becomes law and prevents just one more person from going through the agony I have, then you will have succeeded. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Pratt, welcome.
Chair Brown and members of the committee, my name is Ann Pratt for the record. I'm from Crime Victims United, and I've furnished you with two testimonies. The first one is from Sylvia Howell, who lost her mother to a man named Richard Chavez, who killed her. Her name was Virginia Shirls. In Glide, he was driving down the wrong way of a four-way road, the wrong way. Other motorists honked their horn, tried to get his attention, waved their arms, flashed their lights, and tried to warn other drivers, but he hit them head-on, killing Virginia Shirls instantly and critically injuring her passenger. I'm not going to go into all the details of Sylvia's testimony, but please read it. These are some of the facts about Richard Chavez. He was a repeat high-risk offender. Richard Chavez had a high VAC. It was a .227 at the time of the crash. He had 4 outstanding warrants from Yakima, Washington. Chavez had a revoked Oregon driver's license. Chavez had 11 previous DUIs, including one on a bicycle in Oregon and Washington. And Chavez never finished any abuse treatment or program that he was ordered to by each DUI. And needless to say, there's not such things as car insurance, and there's huge costs. The other one I furnished you with is one of Connie Buchanan. She has asked me to read this for the testimony. I will do my very best to do it quickly. It is...
Actually, you know what, if you can just even
summarize it.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
This death happened in, the first death actually happened in 1994. John Patrick Bush killed David Buchanan. He was actually charged with, I believe it was crim neg, but he served very little time. 10 years later, on the same patch of road, he killed another person. This time his BAC was a .29, I believe. It was a .10 before. Connie also asked that you... she fully supports this bill. Connie has been an alcohol and drug counselor herself. It's a very sad story. This man did receive a sentence the second time, but of only 6 years. It was a man, too. He will be 35 years old when he's out, and history doesn't indicate that he will change his way. We can always hope. I want to point out also that House Bill 2828A is supported by Crime Victims United, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, Governor's Advisory Council, the Oregon District Attorneys Association, the OSPOA, and I have also, I will leave with you, the MAD position paper, and National MAD has also shown an interest in this particular bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. McDonald.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mark McDonald. I'm a senior deputy district attorney from Multnomah County. I'm appearing today on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. We're supporting both House Bill 2828 and 3037. A few years ago, I was assigned as a vehicular homicide deputy for a couple of years, so I actually responded to the scenes where these deaths occurred. And I was always amazed how more often than not the people that were responsible for these horrible deaths had had multiple convictions for driving under the influence in the past. One of the things that we learn in the criminal justice system is that the best predictor for future dangerousness is past behavior. This bill addresses past behavior. People who have either caused deaths or serious physical injury or have had three DUI convictions, which actually means four times because there's also the diversion that's eligible the first time the person's around. I support treatment. The District Attorney's Association supports treatment, but these are people who have not learned from their past mistakes, who have not benefited from treatment. So what this bill will do will guarantee that they're not on the road behind a wheel so they can kill somebody else again.
Thank you. Other questions? We should testify on House Bill 3037 as well.
Yes, the only thing I'd say, I wasn't here back in 1977 when the aggravated murder statute was passed, but I think it's fair to assume that when it was enacted, the legislature thought it covered both of the situations here. It covered reserve officers and witnesses in juvenile court proceedings. Senator Brown, I know that in preparing legal briefs, you've come across the case of PGE versus Boley. The Supreme Court has changed the way that it does statutory construction and legislative intent. It looks first to the clear meaning of the words of the statute. So, you know, I think that it was contemplated when the aggravated murder statute was first enacted and these provisions were made part of it that these situations would be covered.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much for joining us today. Do I have a legislator? Okay. Let's bring up Mr. McDermott, Mr. Powell, and Mr. Roach, House Bill 3037.
I'll be right here. Welcome, gentlemen. For the record, please announce your name and proceed.
Chairman, thank you. My name is John Powell, representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, here testifying on behalf of Senate Bill 3037. Mr. Chairman, the points that the Sheriff's Association has made on this bill and previous testimony have already been made today. With me are two gentlemen from Marion County, one a reserve deputy, the other the commander of the reserve program from Marion County. Brought them here so that if the committee had any question about what a reserve deputy does, that sort of thing, and I just would like them to be able to give you a very brief synopsis of that and see if you have any questions.
Thank you. Senators, my name is Greg Roach. I'm Reserve Commander of Marion County Sheriff's Office. I've been here worked for Marion County for 29 years, probably donated 25,000 hours of volunteer time to the Sheriff's Office. I won't go into too much about the bill itself because I agree totally with what's been said. I can't add too much to that, I wouldn't believe. But I work patrol by myself. I work patrol by myself for 27 and a half years. I take any and every call that comes out. It varies sometimes because of in union issues at times and follow-up. I don't have time for the follow-up, but I've handed homicides to rapes to anything, basically. So it's really important to me that I'd like to think it was an oversight when the bill was originally passed that they forgot to put reserve police officers. I would like to think that they didn't realize that they were admitting that. I have about 40 reserve officers that report to me in Marion County Sheriff's Office, and I'd have a real hard time, I think, going to one of their family members if they were to be injured or killed in the line of duty and try to explain why a reserve officer's life isn't as important as a full-time officer. But like I said, we handle the same calls. You couldn't tell the difference in my uniform or anything other than maybe my badge number, because we have a little different badge number. Our uniforms are exactly the same. Our badges are the same. Our powers are the same. Arrest powers and so forth. So that's basically all I have to say. Thank you.
Chair, members of the committee, I would just testify that. Oh, I'm Kenneth McDermott, Reserve Deputy with Marion County. I've just testified that I have 2 years as an active reserve. We face the same, or we answer the same types of calls. We face the same risks as our full-time colleagues. We stand shoulder to shoulder with them out on the street as we respond to suspects and problems. When people are being violent, we're right there with them, taking the person down, dealing with armed people, that sort of thing. And I would just ask that you give us the same protection under the law as our full-time colleagues. Thank you very much.
Questions for the panel?
Mr. Chairman, if I might, I also put the Sheriff's Association on record in support of 2828 as well.
Thank you. And if you would, please, on behalf of the panel and other members of the legislature, convey our appreciation to the association and to reserve officers in every branch of the law enforcement community in our state.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'd like to bring Ms. Janice Atura, please.
Mr. Chair and Committee, I'd like to introduce myself. My name is Janice Itura, and I'm a member of Crime Victims United and Parents of Murdered Children, and I do support House Bill 3037. In September of 1994, my son Aaron was a witness in a knife assault against another juvenile. Aaron made the decision to step up and agreed to testify against the juvenile offender, Bo Flynn, in a juvenile court October 5, 1994. Everything changed when the mother of the juvenile, Mary Thompson, decided to take the matter into her own hands and ordered the shooting death of my son, Aaron, to keep him from testifying. On October 3rd, at 1:45 a.m., two juveniles broke into my home and shot my son in the back of the head while he was sleeping in his own bedroom. He was 18 years old, a senior at Willamette High School. At 10:45 a.m. that morning, Aaron was pronounced dead. Joseph Brown and Jim Elstead were ordered by Mary Thompson, the known gang mom, to execute my son to prevent him from testifying. Brown received 10 years for murder. Elstead received 16 years for murder. And Mary Thompson was convicted of aggravated murder, receiving life without any chance of parole, the aggravating factor being the murder of a witness in a trial. In April of 2000, Oregon Courts of Appeal overturned Mary Thompson's conviction for aggravated murder on the grounds that the juvenile court proceeding in which Aaron was killed and was to testify did not qualify as criminal proceedings because it was just a juvenile court proceeding, not adult court. The law on aggravated murder says the murder is aggravated if the victim was one of the following and the murder was related to the performance of the victim's official duties in the justice system, a juror, or a witness in a criminal proceeding. In December of 2000, Mary Thompson was resentenced for murder rather than aggravated murder. Her sentence was reduced to 25 years, and she became eligible to get 20% earned time. Only 25 years less earned time for the execution-style murder of my son, Aaron Itura, instead of life for aggravated murder, just because it was a juvenile proceeding. I would like you to imagine for a moment that an adult murderer murders a member of your family, possibly your mother, because they saw and became a witness in a criminal trial. To keep them from testifying, that murderer can be found guilty of aggravated murder. Then imagine for a moment that your sister is murdered to keep her from testifying. Only this time it's just a juvenile trial. That murderer only will be found guilty of murder, not aggravated murder. Both were stepping up and doing the right thing, just as my son Aaron did. But you must understand that they're all just as dead. Aaron got the death penalty, and my family and I are sentenced to life without Aaron. I believe anyone who orders the murder of a witness in any level of legal court proceedings, whether it be juvenile, civil, or criminal, should be eligible for aggravated murder statute. On October 3rd, 1994, my family and I began a life consisting of fear and grief. Little did I know that that nightmare in 1994 was about to begin all over again. Joseph Brown was released from prison January 18, 2004. Now I've learned that the shooter, James Elstead, is scheduled to be released 2008, Bo Flynn in 2009, and I've just been informed with earned time that both will be released in 2006. Mary Thompson is scheduled to be released in February of 2021, or possibly sooner. I have been informed that Mary Louise Thompson has filed a post-conviction relief, which is scheduled to be heard October 11, 2005, in just a couple months. My current fear is that all three gang members will be released in the same county, Lane, community to their families who still live in the same houses in the same neighborhood as I do. Joseph Brown has already made verbal threats, which has been reported to the Oregon Board of Paroles by Brown's own family and myself. I believe that there is only a matter of time before these gang members reunite. I have fears, particularly for my surviving children, and have wondered if my nightmare has really just begun. Please fix the loophole with Mary Thompson that Mary Thompson has escaped through, and don't allow any family to have to go through this as I have. This bill is sponsored by our supported by Crime Victims United and the Oregon District Attorneys Association. And I want to thank you for this opportunity to give you a little bit of my story, and I want to let you know that I do completely support the amendment for the reserve officers as well. And if you have any questions, feel free.
Thank you, Ms. Lightura. Any questions? Appreciate you sharing.
Certainly. I just want to thank you for coming and testifying. I know it's hard to do. I mean, these are very difficult issues, and you know, you have all of our sympathy.
Thank you, Mr. Spengel. All right. Stacy Panis? Robert Castagna? And Kelly Sky? Go ahead. Welcome.
Welcome. Senator Brown, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Stacy Panis, and I am a reserve deputy for the Marion County Sheriff's Office. I'm not in uniform today because I also work here at the Capitol for Representative Morgan. I just wanted to testify today in support of Senator Atkinson's amendments to House Bill 3037. I'm a relatively new reserve for the Marion County Sheriff's Office. I just graduated from the academy in May.
Congratulations.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun. It was about a 325-hour academy, which is close to the same amount of hours that the regular officers and deputies go to at DPSST. I wanted to share with you a story about my first night out with a regular full-time deputy, just to illustrate that in Marion County, reserves are treated the same as regular deputies. My first night riding with a full-time deputy, we got a call of a group of kids at a local elementary school. A neighbor reported that they saw one of the kids with a gun, and they were pointing it at the other kids, and there seemed to be arguing going on. So we took that call. There was three deputies, two full-time deputies, and myself. And even though it was my first night out, I went on that call with them and provided backup, and it is another example of how reserves face the same dangers and the same calls and situations that regular deputies face. As was said before by Commander Roach and Deputy McDermott, we wear the same uniforms, carry the same equipment. There's really no way to tell the difference between a regular deputy in Marion County or any of the other agencies and a reserve. So I would just ask that you would help clarify the statute and afford us the same protections under the law as full-time officers in Oregon.
Thank you. This guy, Mr. Castagna.
Good afternoon, Chair Brown, members of the committee. I'm Kelly Skye, legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and we oppose House Bill 3037 because it is an expansion of the death penalty. It expands the class of people for whom causing the death of will make you eligible for the death penalty. And as an organization, we oppose the death penalty and we oppose any expansion to it. We're definitely not here to say that a reserve officer's life is less valuable than a police officer's, or that a witness in a juvenile proceeding or a civil proceeding for that matter, that their life is worth less than a witness in a criminal proceeding. It's actually precisely that principle, that all those lives are equal, that is behind our opposition to the death penalty. Our death penalty statute in Oregon is already quite expansive. There are 18 separate ways to commit aggravated murder and be subject to the death penalty in the state of Oregon. At some point, this legislative body and people who are morally opposed to the death penalty need to decide to draw a line, a bright line, saying we will not expand this any further. Because each session, somebody will be able to come down here and point out an inequity, such as the reserve officer, peace officer distinction, and ask that they be included in the death penalty statute. And then each session, you will continue to expand this statute as you have over the years. Whether you look at it as an expansion of the death penalty or filling in a hole that exists is really just a question of, is the glass half empty or is the glass half full? Do we subject enough people to the death penalty, or do we subject too many? It's important when you make these decisions also to consider the cost, because nothing we do here at the Capitol can be done without thinking about the cost, and the death penalty is very, very expensive. We spend inordinate amounts of money on the prosecution, investigation, defense, trials and incarceration and death penalty cases. Yet, in the state of Oregon, we're not executing people. Many of you may remember last session, Senate Bill 267 was passed here, which demanded that you look at programs in the state of Oregon using an evidence-based best practices analysis, and to look to see what is actually working and what do we have evidence that is working. And I submit to you that if you perform that analysis on the death penalty, you will see that it's a failure and that we are not executing people in the state of Oregon. If executing a defendant convicted of aggravated murder is a success under that law, then that law is not successful. It's a failure. We would ask that you put those resources somewhere else besides attempting to kill the person. And we would ask that you oppose this expansion, draw a line in the sand, and look at how we can narrow the death penalty, if not do away with it, impose life sentences without the possibility of parole instead of the death penalty.
Thank you. Mr. Castagna, can you wait? Please hold your questions to the end. Thank you. Mr. Castagna.
Thank you, Chair Brown, members of the committee. For the record, Robert J. Castagna, General Counsel and Executive Director of the Oregon Catholic Conference. The conference is the public policy voice of the Catholic Bishops of Oregon in service to Oregon's Catholic population of more than 425,000 Oregonians in support of the common good for all. The Oregon Catholic Conference is here today to oppose House Bill 3037 and any amendments to it, which would add to the class or categories of individuals covered by the aggravated murder statute. We, too, want our testimony to show no disrespect to reserve officers or witnesses in any type of civil or juvenile or criminal proceeding in the state of Oregon. That is not the basis from which we proceed. The Catholic Church organizes its public policy perspectives on a consistent ethic of life basis. The consistent ethic of life holds as its central value the dignity and sanctity of human life,
from conception until natural death, and everywhere in between. So whether the issue before the legislature, state, or federal governments is abortion, whether the issue is euthanasia or assisted suicide, whether the issue is capital punishment, the Catholic Church is there to stand and to advocate for the dignity and sanctity of human life. On March 21st, the Catholic bishops of the United States launched a national Catholic campaign to end the use of the death penalty, and I have provided for the record some of those materials. Cardinal McCarrick, the Archbishop of Washington, led the press conference. I'd just like to read from his statement a paragraph explaining Catholic teaching on the death penalty, since that was referenced in a previous witness's statement. Our Catholic teaching on the death penalty is both clear and complicated. The Catholic Church has long acknowledged the right of the state to use the death penalty in order to protect society. However, the Church has more and more clearly insisted the state should forego this right if it has other means to protect society. Pope John Paul II, the Catechism of the Catholic Church, the Vatican Compendium of the Social Doctrine of the Church, and statements from the U.S. Bishop are all clear and consistent that the use of the death penalty ought to be abandoned in our nation because we have alternative ways to protect society. When Pope John Paul II appeared in St. Louis in January of 1999, he renewed his appeal for a consensus to end the death penalty. For 25 years, the U.S. Catholic bishops have called for the abolition of the death penalty. To expand the death penalty in Oregon would be going in a direction directly opposed to the direction of what we see as a global and universal effort to abolish the death penalty. As a side note, you might make note of the European Union's conditions for Turkey to be considered for membership in the European Union. And one of those conditions was that Turkey abolish the death penalty. I think Oregon sends the wrong message nationally and internationally by expanding the potential application of the death penalty, with the sentence being available to an increasing range of either categories or victims. So we would urge the committee to table this vote, this issue, both with respect to the text of the bill and the amendment before you have been before the legislature before. The legislature, in its wisdom, has seen fit not to advance either concept, and we would urge that House Bill 3037 be tabled by this committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Guy, did you want to testify on House Bill 2828 as well, since you're up here? Wait a minute, Mr. Sestani, I just want to make sure there's no questions for you. I think you're off the hook. Senator Farrell, any questions for Mr. Castagna?
Actually, I do. Madam Chair, I appreciate that very much. I guess it's to both of the opponents in this case. It's just inconceivable to me that we draw the bright line above the murder of a child witness in a criminal case. That's just inconceivable to me. And I guess I wonder if this... if the testimony, if your opposition to that idea came, you had the opportunity to express that in the CAS hearings, and if not, why not? And that's for the...
Both of them.
Well, no, actually, okay. Just for OCDLA, first okay. of all.
Chair Brown, Senator Farrioli, I think you asked two questions. The first being, did we express our opposition to these bills in the House? And absolutely, I've appeared at every hearing that I've seen posted, and I believe I've caught this bill in a number of different hearings and have expressed our organization's opposition to these, both of these principles. The second, what I would say in terms of where to draw the line, I think that, again, each session somebody can comment, and this time it might be a child witness in a juvenile proceeding. Next session it may be a police cadet who was shot mistakenly for a police officer, or a private security officer who was shot mistakenly for a police officer, or any number of individuals who were killed mistakenly for someone listed in the statute. And it's for that reason that I urge you to draw your bright line here today without any further expansion.
Madam Chairman, I just see that this leaves children vulnerable and a possibility of a technical defense. And I guess I'm feeling really strongly that the case that we heard about earlier, the Itura incident, there was another recent incident with almost the same praxis, where people clearly are aware that there's a lower penalty for a murder of a juvenile in a juvenile proceeding. I understand the camel's nose argument, but it seems to me that a witness in a criminal proceeding that makes a decision, a very adult decision, to step forward and offer their testimony on behalf of the people of the state, because after all, it's the people against the miscreant, in this case, in a very serious criminal case, and that witness is murdered, I don't see how you can suggest that that be the place where you make a moral stand against the death penalty. I understand your argument, and Mr. Castagna, I understand the church's unwavering stand on an affirmation to life. What about the life of the victim? What about the life of the reserve deputy? So if you want to affirm somebody's life, let's protect people at risk who are serving the public. And in our globalizing this compassion that we think very hard about the deterrent effect and the people that are on the line for us, the witness that steps up to the plate, knowing that there's a risk, and making, and in this case, a juvenile making a very adult decision to take the risk to protect others who may be subjected to that criminal behavior, and the reserve deputy who takes the oath of his office or her office and puts their life on the line. I think if you want to affirm life, then you affirm those lives. So, I mean, that's maybe not a question you want to respond to, or please do if you wish to.
Well, Vice Chair Farioli, respectfully, my response is that the argument that you present relies on a presumption that I believe many disagree with, and that is that the death penalty actually deters criminal conduct. When, just as everybody, as the proponents of this bill have testified, when they sought to prosecute this witness in the juvenile proceeding, everybody thought that this provision covered that person. In fact, it was a technical distinction made by the Supreme Court. The reality is that it didn't matter what this statute said, that mother was going to order the killing of that woman's child. Whether or not it was covered by death penalty would not have deterred that act. And so I think that the presumption of deterrence is really where we disagree, not as to protecting people's lives and not as to assigning value to people's lives, but this presumption of deterrence.
Mr. Castagna, would you agree with our analysis?
Senator Brown, members of the committee, we come to this issue out of our respect for life, primarily. The church doesn't per se say that the death penalty per se is wrong. But under the circumstances in which we find ourselves in the United States with alternative means to prevent killers from reoffending, that it is unnecessary. But it is rooted in our respect for life. It shows no disrespect to the victims not to have a death penalty when the state has other means to ensure that society is not going to be further harmed by the perpetrator. Since 1973, there have been more than 100 people who have been released from death row. The death penalty is not a perfect system, but the execution of the death penalty exacts a course of conduct that can't be reversed. So, in addition to the fact that the state of Oregon, quite frankly, cannot afford the death penalty in view of its pressing needs, we believe that it is unnecessary in our current situation,
and that the death penalty in Oregon should be abolished.
Mr. Castagna, you mentioned that 100 people have been released. Is that a national figure?
That is a national figure, Madam Chair. Since 1973, more than 100 people have been exonerated from death row after having been cleared of their charges. I'd just like to conclude with Cardinal McCarrick's final statement in the press conference. Cardinal McCarrick, once a supporter of the death penalty, concluded his statement by saying, "I'm not a young man, but as a pastor, teacher, and citizen, I hope I will see the day when the nation I love no longer relies on violence to confront violence. I pray I will see the day when we have given up the illusion that we can teach that killing is wrong by killing."
Madam Chair, I would like just to, not to be argumentative, but I still believe very, very strongly that there is a disagreement among honorable people of good conscience about the deterrent effect of the death penalty, and even among the scientific community. There is no discussion about the deterrent effect that the death penalty has on a killer who's been convicted. And I would just suggest to you that there are people that are divided on the philosophy, there are people that are divided on the science, but not to protect a juvenile witness or a reserve deputy simply is beyond where I would think the bright line needs to be drawn.
Thank you. Ms. Skye, did you wish to testify on House Bill 2828?
Yes.
Okay, why don't you stay?
Thank you.
Mr. Kassan, you're off the hook. Good luck in your career. Oh, I thought he was talking to me. No, I think he wants to talk to me. All right.
Yes, but it's not needed for that.
No, he's not. Yeah. Who am I missing? Mr. Swift, why don't you come on up on 2828? And Ms. Howard, why don't you come up on 2828? And then, let's see, I think we've got just about everybody. And then Ms. Meyer, you'll be, okay, that's all I have signed up. Then, here we go. I think we got it. Okay. All right. Take it away. You want to go again?
Chair Brown, members of the committee, again, Kelly Skye, legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and we do oppose House Bill 2828. I provided written testimony, which I hope has been distributed.
We think in this pile of papers that we received your testimony.
The crux of my written testimony and the first of my argument, which actually I want to proceed by mention that this bill, that we did not testify against this bill in committee on the House side, and I would just point out that this was a gut and stuff amendment into a separate bill.
Okay.
House Bill 2828 originally merely provided that a driver, when applying for a driver's license, sign a statement declaring that they would not drink and drive. This amendment was replaced entirely that bill, and it was not published that the amendment was coming. That said, we do oppose the bill. We and I think that you have two policy questions before you.
Mm-hmm.
The first, which hasn't really been talked about yet, and that is, is it appropriate to put criminal negligence or recklessness into the murder statute? Is it appropriate to call this murder? The second policy question you have before you is, do you want to enhance the penalties under these circumstances, these repeat offenders? And so I think that Representative Shields addressed that second question fairly well. I do have a couple things to add on that note. We've heard from the proponents about one individual in particular who had a prior from 1977, a prior DUI accident that resulted, I can't remember if it was an injury or fatality to the victim. In 1977, driving under the influence of intoxicants was not a crime. Your first offense was not a crime in the state of Oregon. It was an infraction. You could receive no more than a fine, similar to a speeding ticket or a jaywalking ticket. In the state of Oregon. It was not recriminalized until after a case called Brown versus Multnomah County, which is not the important part. The reason that I make this point is to show how far we've come as a society in the way that we view driving under the influence of intoxicants as a crime. It is no longer socially acceptable to drink and drive. That is a 180-degree change in views from 1977. And that social stigma attached to driving under the influence, I submit to you, has done far more to deter drunk drivers than increased penalties have. Representative Shields talked about the number of DUI arrests and fatalities that we currently have and used that to illustrate that perhaps these lengthy penalties aren't serving the deterrent effect that they are supposed to or that they were intended to. And I will leave that to you. Again, this is a deterrence that we were talking about on the previous bill, and I will leave that as a policy decision and the enhanced penalties that you want to attach to this, again, as a policy decision. The other policy decision you have is whether you want to put this into the murder statute, and I submit to you that that is a mistake. All types of different people rely on criminal records to tell them something about the nature and character of a person for whom they need information. Employers, landlords, agencies when you're applying for licenses, the state bar, the medical board, they look at criminal records and they draw conclusions about the character of a person based on their criminal convictions. Murder as a conviction on your record says something about a person. It says that you have a violent character and it suggests a danger to society that is not necessarily present in a person who has even repeatedly driven a car while under the influence of intoxicants and killed people. That person is definitely, no doubt, a danger to society, a significant danger to society, so long as they continue to drink and they continue to drive. But they present an entirely different danger than the person who picks out a victim and kills them. So when you try to put a crime, try to call something a label that it is not, Not only do you pass on with that connotations that don't apply to that person, but you also dilute the meaning of the conviction of murder. If you do this from here on forward, when people look at criminal records, they're going to start to wonder, well, is that murder or is that a drunk driving accident? Is this person a violent person who intentionally killed somebody, or is it somebody who recklessly got into a car and took someone's life? So I ask you to very seriously consider whether it's appropriate to put this in the murder statutes. OCDLA does not think that it's appropriate. I suggest to you that if on the second policy question that you face, whether to increase the penalties in these circumstances, if you decide yes, that you should put those increased penalties into the manslaughter provisions, because that is where they belong. A person who operates a motor vehicle while under the influence of intoxicants and takes the life of another human being or injures another human being and is guilty of assault, that person's record should reflect who they are and what they've done. And it shouldn't, in an effort to appear to be coming down harder on these repeat offenders that everyone agrees should not be on the road, we should not mislabel them. We should choose what it is that we want to do, and we should do it with honesty. It should remain a manslaughter conviction, and you should determine what penalty that you want to impose.
So, Ms. Skye, essentially what you're arguing is that it shouldn't be treated as murder because of the reasons you gave, but would OCDLA oppose the bill if the legislature chose as a policy decision to select a particular crime category that would basically give it, based on the number of prior felonies, the maximum allowable under the guidelines? Is that... Would OCDLA then oppose the bill under those circumstances?
Chair Brown, you put me in a little bit of a difficult position, but I will say that would we certainly are never out here supporting enhanced penalties. Would we oppose it vociferously? No.
Okay.
We oppose mandatory minimum sentences, and we certainly oppose calling a crime something that it's not, just to appear to be acting tougher on that crime.
Okay. All right. Mr. Swift, Ms. Howard, who wants to go first?
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Daniel Swift. I'm the president of the Oregon State Police Officers Association. The OSPOA represents the rank-and-file state troopers that out there enforcing the laws of Oregon every single day. I am a professional law enforcement officer. I've been a police officer for over 19 and a half years, 7.5 with the state of Oregon, 12 prior to that in California. In that time, I spent most of my career in the traffic units as a collision reconstructionist. I hold that title in two states. And in my career, I've arrested over 1,600 impaired drivers. So I have spent most of my career pursuing, apprehending, and incarcerating impaired drivers. And I know more than most people what a scourge they are on society.
Okay.
My attitude on this one is quite simple. If you have a person who wanders from place to place throughout our state, randomly killing our citizenry more than once, we call that person a serial killer. In this case, the only choice and the only big difference in this particular matter is this particular serial killer's choice of weaponry is an automobile and alcohol. Other than that, there's no difference. People are just as dead. And the whole thing with serial killers is the only way we have determined to stop them is to put them away. I would submit that this law is a good law, and it does need to go in the murder statute, because this person has killed before and is now killing again. How many dead citizens do we have before we put these people away? I would also submit that treatment is a good program. Treatment needs to be out there for the impaired driver. However, if you have had three prior arrests for DUI, you've had three prior treatment programs. I don't see a fourth one is going to change your behavior. So the only way, if we cannot change their behavior to keep society safe from these people, is to put them away. And more than any other serial killer, every single person in this room is at risk from this person, because their preferred victim is anybody who happens to be driving on our public highways. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Howard.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Vanita Howard. I'm a member of the Governor's Advisory Committee on Driving Under the Influence of Intoxicants. I've submitted some written testimony indicating our support, but I'd like to depart from that for just a moment, because some references have been made in earlier testimony about the problem of alcohol as far as traffic safety is concerned. There was a time in Oregon back in about the late 1970s when 52% or more of all traffic deaths involved a drinking driver. That figure today is about 40%. I maintain that one of the reasons we have seen that drop in Oregon is because we have gotten tougher on the person who drives under the influence. We still have a ways to go, but we started getting serious about the problem in 1983. Reference has also been made to the fact that DUII was at one time not a criminal offense. It was not a criminal offense for only a very brief period of time. The 1975 legislature adopted a law to decriminalize the first offense of driving under the influence of intoxicants. In Brown versus Multnomah County, they said that was a no-no because the second offense or subsequent offenses were criminal, and I'm not a lawyer, but that was not good. So it had to be put back into the criminal laws after a very short period of time. As a way to get the courts to move these cases through, we then developed diversion, which was the first step toward treatment for these people. Our committee supports the bill because we think these drivers have had more than ample opportunity to get the lesson that they should not drink and drive. Just recently, there was a case in Washington County that I include in my testimony about a man who had been arrested and convicted seven previous times. On his eighth time, he, of course, refused the breath test because, having been there before, He knew full well that without the breath test, it would be more difficult to convict him. If the police had not stopped him that particular night, how fortunate we are that he didn't go ahead and kill someone that night. We just think that he had turned his van into a potential lethal weapon every bit as much as the man with a gun. And we think those people who repeatedly violate this law need to face stiffer penalties than we now have. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Sarah Shields?
I guess I have one question. Are you captain? Is there
a trooper, sir.
Okay. When a person is driving drunk, a repeat offender, hits somebody, kills somebody, what percentage of those people actually get killed in the process themselves? I mean, I appreciate the analogy you were using about the serial killer goes out. But the serial killer has the gun, pulls the trigger, has intent. You know, I think that the drunk driver doesn't get in the car and say, let's see who I can go kill. He gets in the car and he deludes himself into thinking, you know, I can do this safely. Yeah, I got caught before and I went to jail and stuff like that. But he's deluding himself. And I guess what I'm saying is one of the consequences is that at least some percentage of the time, some of those people actually end up killing themselves as well as killing that other person. Are there any percentages is what I'm asking.
I don't have any percentages off the top of my head in terms of how many kill themselves versus killing other people. It's been my experience in my 19 and a half years. Far and away, the victim is the innocent party on the other side. On some occasions, the drunk, in fact, does kill themselves. Vast majority, it's the innocent victim on the other side of the line is the one that ends up dead.
Right. Any further questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate you joining us today. Ms. Pugh and Ms. Meyer. Anybody else wishing to testify on House Bill 2828 or House Bill 3037?
Chair Brown, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU of Oregon, here to testify extremely briefly on House Bill 3037 and any amendments. I think previous folks before me, particularly Ms. Skye, well articulated the position. The ACLU of Oregon, as well as the ACLU nationally, opposes the death penalty and would oppose in this and any other circumstances before this legislature an expansion. So we urge you not to proceed. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Pugh?
Yes, Kathleen Pugh, representative of Oregonians for Alternative to the Death Penalty. Our members do include victims, survivors, and those people are people who do want justice without continuing the cycle of violence. Some of our group oppose the death penalty, and I'm sorry, I don't think I even said that we oppose House Bill 3037, including both juvenile witness and reserve officer. We do feel that both of those groups of people are extremely valuable. We don't feel, however, that the law protects anyone or that the law, any law, should determine the value of any individual. If you add to a bad law, it doesn't improve it. And continuing to add on to the definition of aggravated murder is not effective public policy. So we oppose 3037.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close the public hearings on House Bill 2828 and House Bill 3037. We actually need some more minutes. We need a quorum.
No kidding. Plenty of things.
To the top of the list. Senator Reno, are you ready on 1068? You ready to work the bill? You want to think? You need to make a decision by 4. So I'll let you think about it. Let's move to easier, a less difficult bill. I'm going to open a work session on SJR 24. A direct support of Portland to rename the a terminal after Governor Vicatia. In addition, there's an amendment naming the Department of Human Services building after Governor Roberts. We heard testimony from Senator Starr and Senator Metzger on the Governor Attia provision. It's my understanding that the proponents have no objection to the addition of the information regarding Governor Barbara Roberts. I would be happy to testify if folks need me to, but I think her career speaks for itself. We've spoken with the governor's office and the appropriate folks, and there is no objection to the Department of Human Services building being named for Governor Barbara Roberts. So we're in work session. The chair would move the dash three amendments to SJR 24. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing and seeing none. So ordered. Chair would move SJR 24 with the dash three amendments to the Senate floor with due pass recommendations. Discussion? Objections? So ordered. We're going to let Senator Starr and Metzger, and I'll help them out in carrying the bill. Did you get that? Oh, sorry, Bruce. All right. House Bill 2167. Let's open a public hearing on this bill. Colleagues, this is a housekeeping measure that is back before us because one of our colleagues thought there was an error. The lines that he was concerned about were referring to candidates that only run every 4 years. Thus, there was no need to have the addition of state House members. We think the bill is in appropriate order unless anyone else has found any other difficulties. Ms. Harris, are you aware of any other difficulties with the bill?
None that have been communicated to me, Madam Chair.
Okay. Any other concerns from committee members? Chair would move the engrossed aversion to the Senate floor again with the due pass recommendation. Would you please call the roll?
The engrossed aversion of, I just wanted your record for it.
Of House Bill 2167.
Senator Atkinson?
Yes.
Senator Rico?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Farioli? Chair Brown?
Chair votes aye. Motion carries, and I'll carry 2247. Do we have conflict amendments ready?
Yes, Madam Chair, we do.
Dash A2s.
We do have conflict amendments.
Okay. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2247. As folks may remember, this bill was in front of us yesterday. It is essentially Senate Bill 636, which already passed one of the substantive committees. I believe it was Senator Metzger's committee. Yesterday, we passed out the bill only to learn that there were conflict amendments. The chair would move the dash A2 conflict amendments to House Bill 2247. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered.
Madam Chair, you asked me to carry it yesterday. Is that still
you can still carry it today. We can actually get a vote going. The chair has moved House Bill 2247 with the dash A2 amendments, which are conflict amendments, to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing, seeing none. So ordered. 247.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Senator Shields, would you carry again, please?
Mm-hmm.
2408, we've had some technical difficulties. We need to move that forward. 2588, Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
House Bill 2588A directs OHSU to conduct research projects to investigate the impact of allowing chiropractic physicians to serve in capacities equivalent to that of attending physicians in workers' comp claims.
Thank you. Oh, Lord. Okay. All right. Thank you. There's a fiscal impact on this bill. Chair would like to move this bill to Senate Budget Committee for a conversation regarding the substance of the bill and whether or not we can afford to do this measure. The chair would move the bill to the Senate Budget Committee. Any discussion?
Brilliant.
Any objection? So ordered. All right. 3044. Can we get Representative Kitts? I almost moved him up to Senator. He's in here, room C. I'm going to run. Okay. All right. We're going to send. All right.
Did you hold over 28 and
35 seconds? Yes, I did. 3093 has a number of amendments that are, at least some of them, are new to the chair. She wants to make sure that the proponents of the bill are on board. So I don't know if you guys want to go out and have a conversation. They're the dash 5 amendments. Did we receive another set of amendments? We now have the dash 4s, the 5s, and the 8s. So if the proponents of 3093 would go out in the hallway and see what you all can live with.
Got some conflicts.
Got a conflicts amendments if, depending upon which we adopt. So why don't you go out and have a conversation? You know the answer. Okay. Well, this is good. Oh, Ms. Harris, don't leave me because I don't know which is conflict and which is not. Who wants to come up? Mr. Wilson, Mr. Wiest, work session on House Bill 3093.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. As we've testified before on House Bill 3093, this was a simple agreement made between 290, the plumbing industry, and and DHS to remove the dual certification component so that that licensed plumbers are out of the DHS backflow program. But in return, we said that our plumbers would meet some minimum standard through a state-approved training program. So by virtue of that, we are in agreement with the dash A8s, and that is the only amendment that we agree to.
All right.
Madam Chair, Burton Wiest representing Local 290. Amen to JL's comments. We're opposed to all other amendments.
Okay. All right. Thank you. The proponents of the measure would like the dash 8 amendments. I know that Representative Richardson would like to have the dash A5 amendments. Could someone please call and see if we can get him to testify on those amendments? And we'll be at ease for a few minutes until we can get Representative Kitts here. Three, Representative Richardson, we got some clarification regarding amendments. Want to hear from you on the substance of your amendment, and just briefly, if you don't mind.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My amendment is designed to deal with a situation that's happening where irrigation ditches that used to have water flowing from them would lose maybe 25% of their water through percolation, but now those ditches are being placed in pipes, and so it's affecting wells in areas, and so there's groups of clusters of homes or mobile homes that have been on wells for years that now find it necessary to put together their own water systems, and so this amendment merely gives them a vehicle to do that that provides for a way to assure that if they do put together a local community water system that they have to register covenants that go with the land, mm-hmm. so that it stays with the land, that any costs they agree that they will pay, that if there's any additional houses or lots that join into a rural community water system, that they agree that they will have those covenants go with the land so that there's no problem with getting into it, moving away, and then say, well, who's going to take care of the pipes and who's going to pay for these things?
All right. Questions for Representative Richardson? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's see. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3093. Let's go. If we've seen Representative Kitts.
Come on out, Representative Kitts. House Bill 3044. We're going to let you tell us all about this bill.
Senator Farioli has that look like I can't wait.
I can wait, Madam Chair.
Well, I can't, so go.
For the record, State Representative Derek Kitts, House District 30. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3044 is a pretty common sense bill. Allows people with disabilities to proceed to the front of the line, if there is a line, when it comes to dropping off a ballot or casting your ballot on election day. Pretty simple bill.
Thank you. Representative Kitts, did the House at all discuss the fact of lines 13 and 14 still suggest that folks are voting at a polling place? Or did the... Was there any discussion on that issue at all?
Madam Chair, my understanding is the county clerk's, the office is, by statute, a polling place.
Okay. All right. So it's important that we keep that language in the statute. So next question. We sent over a little bill that would allow the Secretary of State to enter into agreements with county clerks of not more than six counties to allow qualified electors to vote by telephone in eligible elections in those. It's basically a pilot project. It's working with the disability community.
Senate Bill 1046?
That's correct. Did your committee happen to discuss that?
The committee discussed that, excuse me, and in fact it was a big topic of conversation at a HAVA, Help America Vote Act, conference that I attended on June 12th through 14th, dealing specifically with that. I've had conversations with the Secretary of State about that bill. The provisions of that bill allow it out until, I believe, 2012. I'm sorry, I don't have the bill in front of me, but I believe it's out until 2012. The problem with that bill is the technology is not here to do that bill, and there are some concerns, which was the reason for the sunset being out until 2012, hoping that by then the
technology
would be available. So that was essentially, that is, we held a public hearing on it, had some meetings with the Secretary of State's office about it, and that was the concerns that were raised. The bill is not moved.
So not clear about in this discussion about the sunset date. If the sunset date changes, does that address the technology issues?
I don't know if it does or if it does not. I'm not trying to be coy. I just don't know how far along the technology is. It could be 2008. It could be 2010. It may be 2014. I just simply don't know.
Okay. Is there any harm in passing a little bill to allow the Secretary of State the ability to do this, assuming the technology is available until 2012?
Madam Chair, you are the chair. It is your committee. You are entitled to pass any bill you want.
Thank you. Questions for Representative Kitts?
I don't agree, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Farioli.
Madam Chair, I do have a question.
Please.
But if you'd like to talk about other little bills, I've got a few that I'd like to talk about, too, while I'm here.
Sure.
Madam Chair, the question that I had asked about this is, what is the meaning of the word line in a vote-by-mail election? It appears directly to the head of any line of electors waiting to vote or to deposit a ballot. And would that be the line at the post office?
No.
Madam Chair, Senator Farioli, it could be the line, for example, on election day in 2000, there was a very long line at Multnomah County, people waiting to cast their ballots. My understanding is some were waiting over an hour to be able to cast their ballots. In this situation, a person with disabilities would be permitted to go to the front of that line for obvious reasons.
Okay.
Sure, Senator Farioli.
The line was to pick up a ballot or to deposit a ballot?
I believe the example that I just gave you was to drop off a ballot. As you know, if somebody's in line on election day and if the time frame, 8 o'clock, is reached and there are people in line, they are permitted to vote. The line is shut off and they are shuttled through. In this situation, if somebody with a disability were at the end or in the middle of that line, they would be permitted to go to the front of the line, again, for obvious reasons.
Last question.
Senator Farrelly.
Did this come from a national model legislation?
Senator, I don't have the answer to that. I believe that with reference to Senator Brown's previous question on the telephone voting, that is coming to a state near you as a means of Americans with Disability Act and compliance and these sorts of things. So that, I believe, is part of a national trend, if you will, or a national suggestion of legislation for states. I do not know if House Bill 3044's genesis is that.
So I know that the clerk from Multnomah County is here. If you want to ask him, we can bring him up.
Well, perhaps, Madam Chair, in consideration of the essence of time, I'll have a hallway conversation. I'm not opposed to the bill. It just seems illogical to me that we have long lines in a vote-by-mail election.
Well,
and certainly we want to move people that have a disability through the process as quickly as possible.
Madam Chair, one of the concerns, is John Kaufman here?
Come on up, Mr. Kaufman. I think you can tell Sarah Farrelly a little bit about what happens in Multnomah County.
For the record, you can state your name. Oh, that's right.
Thank you, Madam Chair. John Kaufman, Director of Elections for Multnomah County. Senator Farrelly, what happens in Multnomah County is we have a lot of people who either need a replacement ballot, maybe they lost their ballot, they have questions about why they didn't get a ballot, or they come to the office to cast their ballot on Election Day. And so we do have long lines on Election Day, not just people dropping off ballots, but people who have other kinds of business to conduct relating to voting. And if they're in line at 8 o'clock, they get to cast their ballot.
Madam Chair, Senator Farrelly, I will tell you that the one concern that was raised with this particular bill, and I don't know that it's been addressed or has not been addressed, is Gore v. Bush 2000, the U.S. Supreme Court, with regards to equal treatment of ballots, realizing people with disabilities may or may not. I mean, the reality is we're trying to accommodate people with disabilities, but is that treating somebody's ballot and the process differently? I don't have the answer to that. It was a concern that was brought up. So that's it's something, it's food for thought.
All right. Any other questions? You should come to Multnomah County on Election Day. It's quite a wild happening.
I just wonder where the best is parked during the ballot.
Oh, just lines of cars.
Senator Farrelly, I think she's being facetious. I don't think she wants you in Multnomah County.
All right. Any other questions for the panel?
That was good. I like that.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, guys.
Let's see. We were just in a work session. Now that we have a full committee, Chair would move, yes, the -1 amendment to House Bill 3044. We'll just give this little choo-choo train a caboose and see what conversations can happen over in the House. Any discussions? Would you please call the roll?
Yes.
Hi.
Yes.
Oh, all right.
Chair votes aye. The motion carries. Chair would move the bill as amended to the Senate floor for the passed recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing, seeing none. So ordered. Would like to carry. All right, Senator Shields. Take it away. Okay. All right. Let's go to House Bill 3093, Madam Tiffany -8 amendments.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. Okay. Well, you weren't here. I had Representative Richardson come testify about the -5 amendments. I've talked to the proponents. Actually, Mr. Weiss, why don't you come on up?
Oh, no.
Okay. All right. Okay.
Please,
All right. Yes. I had, because we had had a plethora of amendments, I think four on this bill, and I was unaware of the sponsors, I wanted to set the bill over. I had a conversation with Representative Richardson. He came to testify about the substance of his amendments about 20 minutes ago. I am concerned. I think his amendments warrant discussion, but I'm concerned that his amendments will hogtie the bill, so to speak. So we're going to move the dash. The chair would like to move the dash 8 amendments to House Bill 3093. Discussion?
That is a motion?
Yes.
Okay.
Dash 3 amendments. Would you please call the roll?
3.
Dash 8. I said the dash 8 amendments to House Bill 3093.
Yes.
There
we go. Aye.
Sure you did.
I did.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Craigle.
Aye.
Chair votes aye. Motion carries. Chair would move the bill to the Senate floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? Hearing seeing none? You do? Okay. I'm sorry. Okay. What?
I would like to have the dash 5s.
Okay.
Doesn't sound like we're going to get them.
All right. Well, if you want to make that motion, I'm happy to have that conversation.
I would
withdraw my motion to the Senate floor.
Thank you. I would like to move the dash 5s.
Senator Atkinson has moved the dash 5s. Could you tell us, Senator Atkinson, why you feel strongly about the dash 5s?
It's an important issue. It's for Southern Oregon.
Okay.
That's why.
All right.
My job.
Senator Shields.
It's the Rules Committee.
There are lots of nice cabooses on this bill, as I understand it. Why is this one any more important than any of the other ones?
Well, thank you, Senator Shields. Being the custom of the Rules Committee, that the only relating clauses left open in the building are coming through this. This is an issue that came up for some residents in Central Point. It's an issue that's been worked on repeatedly, and it fits nice and comfortably here.
Senator Shields?
Madam Chair, we
have to ask the right question to get the right answer, Senator Shields.
No, I'd like to let people talk on it. My own belief is that this is a bill that took a whole interim to get together and put together, and we kind of had a kumbaya there a while ago where they said the only amendments they wanted to support were the dash 8s. Anything else would encumber the bill. And I think it will get encumbered. You may not make it through the system. So that's why I don't think we should encumber it any more than the advocates asked for.
Further discussion?
Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo.
I would just note that the League of Cities has informed me that they oppose the dash 5 amendments.
All right. Would you please call the roll on the dash 5 amendments?
Senator Atkinson.
Yes.
Senator Ringo.
No.
Senator Shields.
No.
Yes.
Chair votes no. The motion fails. Chair would move House Bill 3093 as amended with the dash 8 amendments to the Senate floor with due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Would you please call the roll?
No.
Aye.
Yes.
No.
Chair votes aye. Who would like to carry?
I might have to serve a little notice.
Notice? That's fine. That's totally fine.
What the heck? I've done two so far. I'll do another one.
Oh, wait, let's give it to Sarah Ringo. Plumbing's up his alley.
Watch out for those that would try to fuck your bill, Senator Ringo.
Am I carrying?
I'd be glad to carry.
Thank you.
Especially if it'll avoid some of Senator Shields' jokes.
Ooh, touche.
I haven't heard any of Senator Shields' jokes.
You aren't listening. I used your Steele joke yesterday.
I was listening.
All right. Anything further on that bill? All right. All right. Holy smokes. Okay. Let's go back up to Senate Bill 1068. Senator Ringo, why don't you walk us through the numerous amendments?
Well,
from when we'll go to 2070.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, yes, yes.
Okay. All right. I'm going to do 1068, 2070, and then we'll go to 3262. Mr. Linden doesn't have anything else to do today.
Right.
All right. Are you ready, Senator Ringo? Should I go to 2070?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Well, just as a little background, you and I both...
Let's open a work session on 1068.
You and I were both conflicted on this. I think the last witness who testified, the judge from Marion County, I think, threw us yet further into...
Amen, brother.
Uncertainty. And in that regard, I think it makes sense not to move forward and create a new crime when this judge expressed such doubt that that would make a difference. And the Dash 2 amendments are the amendments offered by OCDLA, which would allow for the arrest in a the scenario was when an officer goes to, a house and it clarifies that the arrest may occur. And the committee staff was about to scribble a note for me to correct me.
No, not to correct, only to supplement and mention that the Dash 2 amendments also permit that type of arrest to take place, whether the initial charge was for domestic violence or for any other crime associated with one of these release
That's agreements. Right. So with that in mind, Madam Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 1068.
Okay. All right. Senator Ringo has moved the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 1068. Any discussion?
Just to be clear, these are the ones Ms. Sky?
Correct.
Didn't.
All right. Any discussion, any objection to the Dash 2 amendments? You want to call the roll, please?
Yes.
Me either.
Yes.
Aye.
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 Chair votes aye.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo.
I move Senate Bill 1068 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Ringo has moved Senate Bill 1068 with as amended with the Dash 2 amendments to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. I just, for the record, Senator Ringo, like you, after every time I heard someone on each side of this issue, I changed my mind. I think it's fair to say this is definitely a compromise measure. We would like to hear from both the criminal defense attorneys and the district attorneys next session as to the effectiveness of this new legislation, assuming it gets through, and also make an appeal to the state court administrator's office to make a change in forms and also address the issue of forms being in languages other than English. I know that's something they're working on. So very concerned about this issue, and look forward to talking to folks over the next couple of months. So, any further discussion?
Madam Chair, I just want to reiterate. I wish that we could have placed an amendment requiring in larger type, in bold type, the no-contact order, so there could be no confusion or misunderstanding. The relating clause won't let us do that, but I hope the... I hope the Judicial Administration Department does it on their own.
Okay. Anything further? Would you please call the roll?
Aye.
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 That's right. Chair votes aye. Motion carries. Did you want to carry, Senator Ringo? Okay, thank you. All right. Now we just lost our multi-quorum. Marjorie, you're here. Why don't you come on up and do a... help us on House Bill 3262. Okay. All right. We're going to open a work session on House Bill 3262.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I believe you heard this bill yesterday and had a number of amendments. Of particular interest were the Dash 4, the Dash 6s, 8s, and 10s.
Uh-huh.
The 8s turned into the 13s. Jim Green is here to talk about those. And the 8s turned into the 11s. From Brian DeLauschmidt, but I believe that there are members of local government who probably want to talk about the 11s, including Michelle Dykstra, Maria Keltner, and Cassina Squires.
Okay. All right. I'd ask the counties, we're in work session, I'd ask the counties or the local governments to pick one person to talk about the rewrite amendments. Dash four amendments. These are requested by PERS. Anybody need anybody to testify in the dash four amendments? Dash six amendments, Oregon Education Association amendments. Anybody want testimony on the dash six? All right. Okay. Dash eights are now the 13s.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo.
What do you mean the dash eights are the 13s? Were there some changes?
There was some technical fix. Mr. Green, do you want to come on up, please? Okay. That would be helpful.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Green with the Oregon School Boards Association. In reviewing the dash eights, remember this deals with an issue of the definition of final average salary and whether you calculate that as earned when earned or earned when paid. And I believe, Senator Ringo, you requested a memo from Beth Ann Darby and I on that, and you should have that.
Yes.
At your desk there. Earned when earned affects Tier 2 in PERS and the Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan, or OPSERPs. This would change that to earned when paid for school districts, education service districts, community colleges, state of Oregon, and the Oregon University System. The problem with the dash 8s were it only amended the OPSERP plan, or what we affectionately call Tier 3 in some parts of PERS. This now has Tier 2 in it as well.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Green? Okay. So you now need the 13s. The even numbers were very easy for my little pea brain. Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Atkinson.
Do you have an interest in moving the dash 7s?
I am not opposed to having that conversation. My understanding is that they weigh the bill down to a sinking point.
Hmm.
Get that sinking feeling, huh?
All right, so I'll let you ponder that for a moment. Mr. Lashmet and somebody from local governments come up to testify on 10 and 11.
Jason.
You can go ahead.
Sure. Your amendment.
I got someone. For the record, Brian DeLashmet, Oregon Council of Police Associations and sundry other public safety organizations. The amendments that I was describing to you in brief yesterday were the dash 10s. Subsequent to that, in discussions with legislative council on the complexity of a variety of additional issues that were added into the dash 10s, including the issue of mixed service and how those are treated and whether you actuarially reduce people with blended service, part of it PNF and part of it general service, we made a decision just to go back to the most simple approach to deal with the issue that originally raised the issue for me, which is the difference between whether somebody is currently employed as a policeman or a firefighter after 25 years of service and reaches 50 years of age and their ability to use the early retirement versus somebody who is not currently employed. And the statute has been interpreted, read since 1973 that it made absolutely no difference between whether you were still employed or whether your last job was as a police officer or a firefighter. As long as you had the 25 years and reached 50 years of age, you could retire. And so that's what this amendment does. End of story, all of it. I've got a brief three-quarter page summary for Representative Ringo or Senator Ringo and anyone else that wants it, but that's what the dash 10s do. Or dash 11s, excuse
me. All right. Ms. Squires.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Hasina Squires on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon, and I guess I'm speaking hopefully accurately for the League of Oregon Cities and the Association of Oregon Counties. We've reviewed the Dash 11 amendments. It's our understanding that the amendments from the PERS actuary, that the amendments will have a minimal fiscal impact. We've not seen a dollar amount attached to that, so we're under the impression that there will be very relatively little cost. Steve Delaney was gracious enough enough to run some numbers for us of exactly how many people we're talking about who will be affected by this amendment, 158, I think, 128, I can't recall. So a very small number of people. Would just like to put it out there on the record, though, that although, yes, this amendment is codifying what is currently happening, what current PERS interpretation is. Department of Justice has indicated to PERS that they are not doing things correctly, so it's solely a policy decision for you to make whether or not you want to codify it in statute that if somebody works 24 years and is a general service employee and then spends the last 600 hours as a PNF and goes inactive, they can retire early. That's a decision for the legislature to make, and we're neutral. All right. So all of you are neutral.
Correct.
Okay. We like neutrality.
Except
Mr. DeLashman,
for the record, at least two of the other parties are up in the same meeting that I was in. It was the Sheriff's Association, John Powell, and my understanding is they're supporting these Dash 11s. So they are not neutral, along with the chiefs are supporting them, as are the fire chiefs.
Special
and I had a discussion with the fire chiefs.
Okay. Yeah, just to clarify, from the cities and the districts standpoint, we represent the managers. Those are the administrators.
Okay. All right. Anybody else? Did you want to have a conversation about the substance of the Dash 7 amendments?
You think you're a vote anchor? I'm sure I can find a particular avenue.
Okay. I look forward to it. All right. We're in work session. The chair would move the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 3262. Any discussion? Would you please call the roll?
Senator
Atkinson.
Yes.
Senator Rigo.
Aye.
Senator
Keel.
Yep.
Vice Chair
Carey.
Aye. Chair votes aye. Motion carries. And move the Dash 6 amendments to House Bill 3262. Discussion? Please call the roll.
Senator Atkinson.
Yes.
Senator Rigo.
Aye.
Senator
Keel.
Yep.
Vice Chair
Carey.
Aye.
Chair
votes aye. All right. Chair would move the Dash 13 amendments to House Bill 3262. Discussion? Call the roll.
Yes.
Aye.
Yep.
Aye.
Chair votes aye. Motion carries. All right. Chair would move the Dash 11 amendments to House Bill. You don't have the Dash 7 amendments? Okay. Nothing. I'll move the Dash 11 amendments to House Bill 3262. Any discussion? Would you please call the roll?
Yes.
Aye.
Yeah.
Aye.
Chair votes aye. Motion carries. Chair would move the bill as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any objection?
Yes.
No, are you serious?
I am.
After all that? Okay.
I'll see if I can't give it some.
All right, please call the roll.
No.
Aye.
I don't know yet. Let me think about it.
Frank.
Okay.
Come to the dark side.
Come to the dark side.
Okay, where were
we? I'll go with Charlie. Yep.
Yes.
Chair votes aye. Motion carries. I'll carry it.
And I'd like to thank the small districts and cities for that rousing neutrality. Very helpful.
It was extremely helpful. Okay, we got a sick body in the audience. Let's move up House Bill 2591 for public hearing. Mr. Linden. Oh, man.
Come on, man. Change your vote.
Hi.
By the way, Madam Chair, in that last bill, a relating clause killed a lot of trees.
Yes.
I just wanted to...
The rules.
Mr. Linden, tell us why we should pass House Bill 2591.
Madam Chair, for your record, Bill Linden, representing the Oregon Restaurant Association. House Bill 2591 is designed to strike a balance between discouraging frivolous suits involving obesity and weight gain while preserving legitimate suits dealing with other aspects of food such as misbranded or adulterated foods. In working on 2591 in the House, we consulted at length with Rich Lane, the legislative chair of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, and got to a point with some amendments that we adopted in the House where OTLA is now neutral on the bill. What this bill essentially does is, number one, in Section 1, it provides a uniform definition of what we mean by the word food. And what we did there was we adopted the United States Code definition. And that was important because if you start to try and define it term by term, this would be a much longer bill than you'd be looking at today. We also included very specific language. Again, we're still in Section 1. If you look at line 19 and line 20, about this not applying in cases in which there's been adulterated food, and that's, again, defined in our statute, and misbranding, again, defined in our statute. It also provides a provision that the knowing and willful violation of any other state or federal law relating to the manufacturing, marketing, distribution, advertisement, etc., would not trigger the provisions of this bill. And that is a violation is knowing and willful if the person engaged in the conduct that constituted the violation with the intent to deceive or injure or with actual knowledge that the conduct was deceptive or injurious. We also provided that if you look in on page 2 in section 3, that in any action for a claim or injury caused by a food-related condition, all discovery is stayed during the pendency of any motion to dismiss. However, and this was language that was added in the House amendments, the court on good motion, on motion and for good cause shown, may order that specified discovery be conducted notwithstanding the stay, and that would be designed to let the plaintiff adequately respond to the defense motion that was pending before the court. So, again, what we think we have here in total is a balanced approach to an issue that is beginning to take on more and more currency nationwide. And we think that what we've done here is discouraged the frivolous suits and protected victims' opportunity to pursue legitimate claims. So with that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to respond to any questions the committee may have.
Thank you. Mr. Linden, just to clarify the record, there have been no lawsuits of this type in Oregon. Is that correct?
Not to date, Madam Chair.
Okay. All right. Any other questions?
And where have there been lawsuits?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, New York has been the most fertile ground to date. However,
it's the cheesecake, Madam Chair.
There is legislation of this sort pending across the country. I believe 14 states have already passed it this year. So it appears that this type of legislation is out in front of the filing of litigation in many states, and probably will have the intended effect of deterring the filing of that type of litigation.
All right. I guess my thinking about it is frivolous suits are in the eyes of beholder, so to speak, you know, whether they're frivolous or not. But you're saying it's out in front of those suits which would have been filed that are frivolous, that don't cut off substantive ones?
Madam Chair, Senator Shield, that's correct. I mean, we clearly acknowledge that if there is a claim under a adulteration issue or a misbranding issue, that those need to go forward. Clearly, if there's been an intent to deceive, a knowing intent to deceive, that type of a claim could go forward. What has been the experience in the state of New York is that these suits are filed, massive discovery motions are filed, discovery is ordered to be provided, the plaintiffs then dismiss the case, go in, review the discovery they received, come back, refile, and it's sort of a cycle that appears to have no end to it at this point. But we think that this suit, or that this legislation allows, again, the legitimate claims to move forward, and just this simply discourages the frivolous claims.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, yes. And for you, Senator Shields, in 1995, we addressed the frivolous lawsuit provision by beefing up the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure. I believe the specific number was 17. So we did beef up. Yeah. Yeah. So, okay. Please go home.
Thank you.
Yeah. Anybody else wishing to testify on House Bill 2591? We'll move this bill forward, but not today, but it will move in short order. And my understanding is there needs to be no further action on it, so we're in pretty good shape. If I can get the attention of committee members, we can finish our work and not come back this evening.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo.
My understanding is we have the amendments on House Bill 2599. We need to make copies.
Okay.
And that'll be done in probably 3 minutes.
All right. Let's go back up to House Bill 2070. The chair moves the suspension of the rules for reconsideration of House Bill 2070.
Thank you.
Any objection?
Madam Chairman.
Senator Farrioli.
No objection to the suspension of the rule to reconsider the decision on House Bill 2070.
Thank you. Seeing none, the chair would open a work session on House Bill 2070 for the purposes of considering the Dash 5 amendments.
Madam Chairman, I move the Dash 5 amendments to House Bill 2070.
Senator Farrioli has. No, you might want some discussion first.
The messenger here.
Okay. You really want to have discussion after the motion?
Well,
okay.
I've made the motion, Madam Chair.
Okay.
And then that would proceed us to the discussion.
Senator Farrioli has moved the Dash 5 amendments to House Bill 2070. The chair is opposed to the motion. It is in totality the Speaker's Stability Fund, which we will be hearing either Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, or Monday or Tuesday, given the Speaker's schedule. But happy to talk about it here. Would you please call the roll?
Well, Madam Chairman, to the motion.
Sure, Senator Farrioli.
Thank you. Madam Chairman, the Dash 5 amendments actually are the school stability plan, as you have mentioned. There's a slight difference. It's 53%. 9% growth rate on each biennium. And it also begins in 2007-2009 with a base of $5.318 billion. It is more generous than any other plan that has been presented to date. It provides stability and certainty. It gives clear direction for school districts for future budgeting processes. It gives predictability for the funding of education. And it takes what I hope is some of the politics out of the K-12 budget. But, Madam Chair, that's not all the bill does. There's more. Madam Chairman, it also adds all-day kindergartens. Funds full-day kindergarten from the state school fund for schools that choose to offer it. It's permissive. Studies show clear academic gains for students that attend full-day kindergartens compared to half-day programs. It provides the greatest benefit to the most vulnerable and needy in the lowest socioeconomic backgrounds. It also provides more opportunity to spend time on educational basics and prepares kids for learning experience. Also included in the amendment are block grants for transportation funding. What that does is fund school district transportation costs on a block grant basis instead of funding them as a total percentage of their transportation costs. Transportation will be funded on a certain set amount per ADMW. It would deliver what the chalkboard project estimates at a $30 million savings. It also encourages a lot of innovation and cost reduction at the school district level, so it incents cost cutting. Also included is the high-cost disability grant. In this case, it takes the $25,000 per student cap up to $30,000, and it grants a total of $17 million in limitation, so that's an increase. It helps districts with very high cost students, and it's sort of like an insurance or a stop loss policy for those districts that have high cost. Madam Chair, that that tends to be the metropolitan districts. Students are moved by their families to areas where they can obtain high-quality medical care. And also, Madam Chair, this amendment includes the small high school supplement, and that is a distribution proportional to high school average daily membership for small high schools. Those districts must be with less than 8,500 weighted average daily students. Those grants are essentially designed to help provide small high schools with the opportunity to have comparable education programs to large schools in metropolitan areas. Madam Chair, what we have tried to do is put together the very best educational package for funding that we can, with actually the highest opportunity for stability and a base that starts at $5.318 billion for the 07-09 biennium. Madam Chair, this is probably the very best package that we'll see this session. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Farrioli. Look forward to discussing the merits when we have the actual bill in front of us. Any further discussion? Would you please call the roll?
Senator Atkinson?
Yes.
Senator Riga?
No.
Senator Shields?
No.
Aye.
Chair votes no. The motion fails. So chair would close the work session on House Bill 2070. Let's move to 2599. We now have amendments. Senator Ringo, on a work session on House Bill 2599.
Thank you, Madam Chair. These are the B-12 amendments, and to refresh the committee, this was the bill where we had the, it was rather some entertainment anyway on the Senate floor related to the minority report, where the minority report won, and then we pulled it back, then we pulled it back to the Rules Committee.
What?
Yeah, it's shocking, I know. And the
well, we'll go back with just a second, Senator Ringo, please. The minority report won?
Yeah. Oh, you recall this. This is the the Willamette Week a water hog bill.
The second time this year?
No, first.
And so the B-12 amendments attempt to reach a compromise on that so that the water district or other public district, other utility, does not have to release the personal identifying information such as the name, the driver's license, the social security number, unless, of course, the customer consents. But in the case of a water district, they would have to divulge the amount of water used together with the address, and that way, if a certain publication wanted to do a certain article, they would still be able to do it, although it would take a little bit more work because then they'd have to find the names of the people who lived at the addresses. So it's kind of intended to be a compromise in that regard. And I would note that Senator Przanski, who had strenuous objections to the majority report before, is fine with this, to my understanding.
Because despite the public records request, the water body is not required to release personal identification information such as driver's license, social security number.
That is right.
Okay.
And Madam Chair, even the name.
So simply the address.
The address and, for example, the amount of water used.
Okay.
So let's say you wanted to do an article on this. Well, it would be a little bit more work because then you'd have to find out who's living at a certain address, although that is readily available from public records relating to real property.
Yeah, that's fine. Okay.
So the other part of this is to clarify a discussion that we had earlier on the Senate floor relating to the scope of a public records request for home computers. And it clarifies that if there is a personally owned computer, that the information is subject to the public records request only if it relates to public business.
And it's my understanding from Ted Rutlinger, it's his belief that that is already the law. But nevertheless, despite there's some ambiguity around that, so that clarifies this. And I specifically want to say that this amendment is not intended to change the law in any way with regard to how a public records request relates to a public computer. Mm-hmm. For example, just because we're clarifying this for a home computer, a privately owned computer, we are not intending to say anything about how a public records request may apply to information on a publicly owned computer.
All right, Senator Ringo, we're in work session. Since we all just received the amendments, I'm going to set this one over till tomorrow.
Okay.
So that people, everyone, is that okay with everyone? So that you can read the amendments, make sure everything's okay, make sure we can all go up hand in hand. Senator Ringo.
I guess I'd also like to just state for the record that at least with regard to the issue on privately owned computers, we've checked with both the ACLU and with Tom Gallagher, who represents publishers, and they've both stated that they're okay.
All right.
Madam Chair.
Senator Shields.
You made the statement that we would all have a chance to read the amendments. Are you referring just to Dash 12?
That's
the
correct.
Relevant ones at this point.
I'm sorry, Senator Shields. I misspoke.
No, I'm going to be clear.
Yeah, no. I think these are the only amendments. Senator Ringo, Senator Prezansky, who else, ever else worked on this great work, you guys, let's close the work session on 2599. Open a work public hearing and work session on House Bill 3374. Mr. Schlott, did you have someone else that you wanted to testify as well? Okay, why don't you come on up?
Hurry.
Yes, sir.
I've been here for hours, man.
Yes, that's true.
Right. You signed up for this.
Sauntering up here.
Yeah, I know. It's fine.
Chair Brown and members of the committee, Art Slack with the Association of Oregon Counties, here in support of House Bill 3374. This is a very simple little bill. What it does, it is establish in statute a 30-day time frame for somebody who comes to the state of Oregon to register, title, and get an Oregon driver's license. Heretofore, the statutes have been silent with regard to how long you can be in the state of Oregon without doing these three items at this point. We think that having the 30 days in statute will encourage people when they come to the state of Oregon to comply, to register title, and to get an Oregon driver's license. We would note that the state of Washington has a 30-day time frame to do these things. The state of California has a 20-day time frame to title, register, and get a driver's license once you qualify as a resident. Would also note, Chair Brown, that this bill passed the House 57-0, and it's supported, or it, their ODOT is fine with the bill as it is. So, Madam Chair, we'd appreciate your support and passage of House Bill 3374.
All right. Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Schlack?
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. I need Senator Ringo.
Are you okay with this?
EUPS. She was here.
Back,
yeah.
Back looking mirror.
Yeah.
That many companies,
yeah.
But
yeah.
The looking mirror. What?
The UPS mirrors.
You didn't hear that bill on the floor today.
Thank you. No. Doesn't leave the house, doesn't matter. We'll give it a hearing. Who knows? Is he coming quickly?
Yes.
Okay. Do I have to go out there and scream?
I'll go.
It's okay. Yeah, we did. You were out.
Oh, that's
right. I did.
Okay. All you did
was clear
for something.
Yes. Right. That's correct. Yes, yes. There was a technical that we can get somewhere. All right. Okay.
Come on, Arch.
All right, we're in work session on House Bill 3374. Now we lost Senator Farioli. The chair would move the dash four amendments to, here he comes, House Bill 3374. Your timing is perfect.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
These are Senator Walker's UPS mirror. The bill has not even been able to get a hearing in the House. So we think this merits another conversation.
Question, Madam Chair.
Senator Farioli.
This sounds eerily familiar to a lot of testimony I heard today on a bill with forward-looking heirs. Wasn't that the
this
same
is the bill.
Bill.
This
the
is
same the bill.
Bill. Yes.
So
we didn't
she heard
vote
it earlier.
On
she testified this morning, this afternoon at 1 o'clock. I'm sorry.
Hours ago.
Oh, I
hours
beg your pardon. I have this all yes. running together, Madam Chair.
Okay.
I thought it was during the floor session.
No, but you are correct. She did testify.
Sort of pained cadence to it.
Deja vu all over again. All right. Would you please call the roll?
Aye.
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 Chair votes aye. Motion carries. Chair would move the bill as amended to the Senate floor. Do pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing seeing none. So ordered. We'll let Senator Walker carry this bill. Any other business to come before the committee?
Comment, Madam Chair.
Yes.
The Senate Minority Leader deeply appreciates the opportunity to have the amendments, the Dash 85 amendments to 2070 heard today in the committee.
Your appreciation is noted. You're welcome. We will look forward to hearing that issue further. Senator Atkinson? Okay. All right. Thank you very much. The bills that did not move today will be under consideration and discussion. So don't know when they'll be coming back and what the time frame is. With that, we're adjourned. Thank you all very much.